That afternoon, Larry attended a trade gathering in the Baltimore Convention Center, luckily just a stone's throw from his office because any farther travel would have exhausted him. He stood in the corner of the huge ballroom on the fourth floor, amidst a sea of dark-suited delegates. Most were male and white, with a few Asians and blacks. A handful of indigenous people from the Pacific Northwest, in red and black button blankets, brightened the affair and kept Larry awake with their drumming, which fascinated him as the tempo changed subtly, likely not noticed by many listening. After they finished, a string quartet filled any holes left in the soundscape, so soporific that Larry had to struggle harder to stay awake. A tall South Asian fellow approached him, dressed in a stylish dark ochre suit with light ochre silk shirt and mustard tie. He said, "Larry, you still hate parties or just pretending?" "Perfecting my act." "Hey, it's good to see you, Santu. How are you?" Santu grinned, his teeth broad rows of shining white. "Too busy to tell. Must be what I wanted or I wouldn't have left the octopus's garden." "In a blaze of stuff at glory. We'll take you back in a minute. You might be interested. Big changes afoot. Big battles with big dorks, too, but I'm going to win." "Bet you are. But I don't know. I ratted, and you know what Churchill said. Takes a certain amount of ingenuity to re-rat. Don't think I'm up to it." "Well, the door's open. We can't match perks and fringes, but listen, we can give you more work and responsibility than you ever dreamed of, with a modest raise in pay and no authority whatever." Santu laughed. "How can I resist?" "You're looking good, keeping fit. How's yoga with your uncle?" "Not. He had a stroke a couple months ago. Then last week, a bit of surgery nearly finished him off. In fact, it did. It's a miracle he survived." "What happened?" "He was in for some tooth and jaw exploratory stuff. Nothing he wanted to talk about or worry us over. Auntie was a bundle of nerves, so we went with her to wait during the surgery." February 11th. In the Johns Hopkins Hospital, in an operating theater, heart and brain wave monitors go flat. A large wall clock says 6:07 p.m. At the head end of a draped body, a surgeon works feverishly, attended by a nurse, anesthetist, and technician. "Forget it," the tech says. "We're done." She flips off several switches. To everyone and no one, the surgeon says, "Sorry. Bloody goddamn sorry." He snaps off his gloves and goes directly to tell the family, sitting in a nearby waiting area. The eyes of the middle-aged daughter, son, two teenagers, and Santu are keenly on him. "Your father. Your grandfather. Yes?" The surgeon closed his eyes, taking a deep breath, and says, "I'm sorry." His heart couldn't take it. His voice drops. "He died about 10 minutes ago. We did everything we could, but..." Santu stays strong. The others are devastated. Inside the operating room, the elderly male patient moans and eyes flutter open, clear and bright. Larry asks Santu, "What day did it happen?" "Last Friday." "Really? I've got Fran on an oddball file, bunch of survivals, about that time." "Hey, she was brilliant with little Angela. Electric stuff, how is she?" "Working things out like the rest of us. Why don't you ask her yourself? Give her a call and maybe have lunch. She's in town for a month. Tell her about your uncle, too, if you don't mind. It fits the file." "Yeah, I'd love to see her. I've got a couple days free before my pin moves on the map." Email from Santu Singh to Fran, date February 18th, 12:43. Subject, lunch pronto. "Hey, Fran, saw Larry yesterday. He says I have something for your file. Miss you guys. Any chance for lunch today? 12 at the roll-ups near you? Santu." At 10 to noon, Santu wheeled his turbaned Uncle Sid with his tidy beard into a new California roll-ups restaurant, bright with sunbursts, cactuses, and tomato everything decor. At noon, the hostess showed them to their table. Santu locked the brakes on the wheelchair, then sat to his uncle's left. A server brought three menus. At 5 past noon, the server poured 3 glasses of water. At 12:10, Santu checked his watch. His uncle sat impassively. Fran flew in at 12:15, carrying the messy file folder marked coincidentals. "Sorry," she puffed. "Is one big red light district out there." Santu rose to give her a warm hug. "No problem. We still have 45 minutes. He discreetly positioned Fran to Sid's left and said, "Uncle Sid, I'd like you to meet Fran. Fran, my dear Uncle Siddharthan." Sid offered his left hand, which Fran squeezed gently and said, "Delighted." Santu offered Fran his chair. She sat with the file folder on her lap. He slipped into the remaining chair, then leaned close to whisper, "He's had a stroke. Can't see anything on his right side." A server quickly appeared. Santu said, pointing to his uncle, "Soup and buns here, and today's special for me." Fran gathered up the menus and handed them to the server. "Tuna tango, thanks." Santu nodded toward her file. "So what's the story?" "Larry's pocket full of miracles. Take a look." Santu flipped through copies of news clippings and notes in May's distinctive hand and black felt pen with red underlines of key words. As he skimmed, he summarized, "Girl survives major fire in Lima, no burn. Swiss man survives fall off 500-meter cliff, walks away. Chinese woman found on mudslide that buries her family. Shipwrecked fisherman washes up on shore, all other hands lost. Your miracle kid, famous little Angela Dozens here. Uncle Sid, too, I guess. Did Larry tell you?" Fran shook her head. Santu quickly recounted his uncle's operating room recovery. Fran said. "Check the dates. February 11th, February 12th. All about the same time, give or take some time zones." "Ooh, freaky. Nah, I keep thinking of Pope John the 23rd's dying words. Any day is a good day to be born. Any day is a good day to die. You can slice that down to the second. People are a-bornin' and a-dyin' and defying the odds all the time. With so many billions of us, for Pete's sake, coincidences are inevitable. Larry agrees? Or is he looking for a job at the Inquirer?" "Ooh, now that is freaky." Fran pointed to the label. "It's marked coincidental, so I'm taking it from there." "Taking it where?" Fran shrugged. "Who knows? I just started. Touchy to report, I'd think." "Yeah, and if I can't think of an angle, then that's how it goes. The newsroom floor is littered with false leads, pointless hunches, half-baked stuff that doesn't make it." Santu said, "and some of the best stories around." The server brought Sid's soup. Santu offered the spoon to Sid's clenched left hand. He gently pushed Santu's hand away and slowly extended his fist to Fran, opening it to reveal a dark, rough stone about robin's egg size. Fran said, "Ah, a rock. Schist, maybe? I'm no geologist." Sid slowly closed and withdrew his hand. Santu said, "He's been clutching it since the operation. Can't explain it, of course, because of the stroke." "When did he have the stroke?" "Last November, apparently unrelated to what went wrong. I wonder, though, both heart, blood, circulation related." Sid beseeched Fran with earnest eyes. She said softly to him, "Thank you for showing me. I'll make a note of it." Sid's eyes brightened with tears. He shakily tucked the rock into a leather pouch hanging from his neck. Then, with difficulty, began eating his soup. He grunted his approval. Santu said to his uncle, "Glad you like it." To Fran, he said, "Uncle Sid's a wonder, 100 times over. My hero since I was a kid." Sid beamed a lopsided smile. The server delivered wicker baskets with roll-ups in big nests of sprouts and ruffled greens. Santu asked Fran, "So what else is new?" "Nothing, except that I'm this far from quitting." She made a narrow space between thumb and forefinger. His eyes widened. She continued, "So Larry gave me a month to play with this and hang out with my kid. What's wrong?" Fran shrugged. "With work? Nothing. I found Angela, and that was it for me in the news-chasing game. Like that," she snapped her fingers. "Nothing wrong with the Anne, either, if I can get a grip on all her wild energy." Santu laughed. "Mum's girl, eh? She must be, what, 10, 11 now? 13. "No kidding. We're getting old, Fran. At warp speed. How about you? You know, I still can't believe you left us. And for mere money, prestige, security. Such a crass move, Santu. They treating you right?" He shrugged. "Right enough. I'm off to Beijing tomorrow. Big tech launch, then Hong Kong for follow-up. Interviews in Taiwan. You know the beat." Fran heaved a sigh. "Oh, yeah." She took a bite of sandwich. "Good tuna. Supposedly sustainable, whatever the hell that means. When we'll have more plastic than fishes in the ocean by 2050. God, there's no escape. Guilty with every delicious bite. You think too much. The show's the thing. The show and tell." Fran smiled. "The show and no tell. That's my thing now." The clock on the closet door in Fran's home office said 2:47 p.m. Fran sat nose to her computer monitor, staring at a blank new document. She fiddled with a cigarette, a candy one. She wrote a short sentence, then backspaced it out. She started typing again, then stopped, highlighted and deleted the whole thing. She flipped impatiently through the coincidentals file. Finally, she dialed the phone. "Hi, Lair. Got a minute?" Larry answered on speakerphone. "Yeah, hi, Fran. Got some sanity? Our favorite trendoid just left. I thought not having a budget would keep him down, but he's finding ways to produce crap for nothing. He used a university class to do a miserable little piece, and he's pissed off now because I won't let him show anyone their lousy effort. I told him that. If he stages a penthouse demo behind my back, well, we're getting down to the shootout at OK Corral. It's him or me, I tell you. So, come join my salsa team. I do the tomatoes, you do the peppers, we share the onions and tears. No way. You take half my chair and we gang up over your dead body. She caught Larry off guard. He said nothing. Fran continued, like never, pal. Hey, I saw Santu for lunch today. He brought his Uncle Sid. Lucky you. Fits the file, doesn't he? By timing, perfectly. But he'd had a stroke months before the operation. Did Santu tell you that? He's lost his words. Who knows what's behind his big, lovely speechless eyes? I'm calling because Santu got me thinking. He asked a question I couldn't answer, the very first one I should have asked. Why look into this file? What's the point? An old cousin sent it to me, landed on my lap just before you marched in and made your Declaration of Independence. It was handy and, well, I'm kind of interested, whether anything reportable comes out of it or not. You really think that there's something going on, something connecting all these survivals? I don't know, but somehow all those suckers made it, fooled the big one. True, but hey, I didn't know you were interested in this kind of stuff. You going all fringy on us, Lair? Looking for a mirror to keep you young for life? Nah, too late. But what if this is the new Immortals Club? What if they need a president? Fran laughed. Well, I vote for you, hands down, both hands up. Seriously, Larry, what do you want? I want you, hot from Angela, to apply the peripherals thing to her buddies in the file. Forget the obvious stuff in the middle. Keep checking the edges. Fran snorted. Outer limits, you mean? I really just see it as the bell curve of luck. With enough people in the world, you're bound to find some on the lucky and unlucky extremes, and things happen in bunches. That's how random numbers work. It's a statistical thing. So take that angle and run with it. I might. Otherwise, I'm just an old cow with this, chewing her cud. Nothing's hit the first stomach yet. It'll be out the back end before I've gotten anything out of it. Larry laughed. Then we'll run through the plops together. Did you know that they squish wonderfully between your toes when they're fresh and warm? The old cousin who gave me the file told me that. So, how are things in your corner? No corners. It's the Roma Circus. I fight with Deanne, I fight with Ralph, I fight with myself. You want a round? Larry chuckled. With you, any time. Fran's voice softened. I'm really glad to be home, bruises and all. I'm glad this WTF file makes it possible. Thanks, Lair. Deanne appeared in the doorway, unseen and unheard, just home, directly from school. She watched her mom's back as Fran said goodbye into the phone and returned to staring at the monitor and toying with the candy cigarette. Deanne shouted, "What the hell are you doing?" Fran jumped and spun around. "Ah, I'm not smoking. It isn't lit. It's still cheating." "No, it isn't. The patch is cheating. This is just a soother, a distraction. Can I have one? I won't light it up." Fran took a bite of the assumed cigarette and chewed it. Don't smoke anymore. Just eat 'em. You want one?" She took another from the package beside her keyboard and threw it to Deanne, saying, "Fiddlesticks, literally." Deanne caught it, looked it over, and took a bite, saying, "Calories, Mum, you're going to get, like, huge, because you don't smoke?" "Oh, probably more to love, darling. So, how was your day?" "Boring. You got homework?" "A bit, but it's Friday, all right. Don't start nagging. So let's go out. Do something." "Like what?" "Pizza and ice cream, you know? Do something. Like what?" "Pizza and ice cream? That new, you know, flick? Part two? What's its name?" Mind just blank. "Mum, I'm not a little girl. Porn flick? Escargot?" "Oh, God, you're so weird. What would you like to do?" "Really like to do?" "Yeah." "Nothing you'd do anyway." "You sure?" Deanne shrugged. "Yeah, well, probably." "So what is it?" "Getting tattied with friends? Nose rings? Shooting pool? Designer shave? Dyed hair thing? Give me a clue." Deanne muttered shyly, eyes on her sneakers. "I want to see Angela." Fran held her surprise for a beat, then tapped the file. "This one?" Deanne nodded. Fran asked softly, "Why?" "I read some of your file, okay? Don't blow, okay? I'm just, like, bored, and it's interesting." "No problem. Read it all. Or maybe you have." "Just mostly the Angela stuff." "What's the fascination?" "I don't know. Must be hard losing your family like that, then sitting in the jungle for two whole days." "Yeah, hard even to imagine. She was awesome. Is awesome. I should call her, shouldn't I? I promised I would." Deanne said almost inaudibly, "I already did." "Really? Oh boy. Now you're pissed. I knew it. I should never." "No, it's okay. It's good. What did she say?" She said she'd like to see you, me too. We could go visit. And you said we would? The Anne shrugged. Maybe. Darling, this is my month home. See, I knew it was stupid. I knew I never should have said anything. You and your stupid job. You go when you want, stay when you want, send me to Dad and Cinderella when you want. God, gag me. Then you drag me home. I don't have to. Wait. You think of this as home? I don't have a home, and I don't need one, and I don't need you and your stupid job or stupid Angela or anybody. I'm just, like, so fed up, and I'll deal with it, all right? So butt out. Anne turned on her heel and ran out of the house, leaving the front door open. Fran followed quickly, shouting while running, "Anne, don't do this! Anne!" Half a block down the street, Fran saw Anne disappear through a pedestrian shortcut between front yards and the next block. Winded and fighting tears, Fran stopped. Damn. She texted Anne immediately, knowing it was a waste of time. She called Ralph at work. "Ralph, Anne just blew up and took off, and I don't know where she's gone. What's her pattern? Where do I start looking?" Ralph groaned. "Oh, no." He stood up from his desk and started pacing. "Check her friends. Go to the mall. What happened?" "She wants to go to Oregon. I didn't jump to it, and boom, she hit the street."
"Oregon?"
"She wants to see Angela, the girl I rescued." "So why don't you take her? Have a holiday with your kid. And forget school, I suppose. Solid C's don't win any instant trips in my book. Besides, it's my job, and I'm not up to a weekend jaunt to Portland. I'm home for a month. Home alone. Damn you, are you going to help or just kick me every chance you get? Sorry. Let's start with her friends. We've got a list of them at home. I'll get Cindy calling, and she's got GPS on her phone, right? We can track her if we have to." "Like how? Call the cops right now to get them following her? She just left. She's got friends, you're right. If Cindy will check with some, I'll drive around a bit. Check at the malls. Call the second you know anything, okay?" The aunt stormed her way through shortcuts, neighborhood parks, and school grounds. On a side street, behind a bus stop, she sat on a low rock retaining wall. She had to shut down the tracker Ralph and Cindy put on her phone, something she'd promised never to do. That done, easier than she expected, she then quickly found and installed a free VPN with a choice of three countries to tunnel to. Australia looked good. A motorcycle roared up and slowed beside her. A small, good-looking young man on it, full leather, said, "Hey, kid, where's the fire?" The Anne walked quickly away, ignoring him. He kept pacing, taunting. "You're a J.C. Junior high brat, right?" The Anne kept her head down. "Fuck off. J.C.'s my turf. I'm Brad man. Everyone knows Brad. I'm the source, right? Like the only source." "Well, I got a big order for you. Leave me the fucking alone." "Hey, smartass. I like smartasses. Name your price, The Anne." She stopped and looked at him. "How'd you know my name?" "I know what's going down. Tiffany, she's my sister, right? She says you bought from a real loser last time. Whole school knows it." "That's crap. I never bought a thing." "Tiffany's your sister?" The aunt snorted. "That's too funny." "Say that twice, I dare you." "She's, like, cool, and you're..." "Like what?" Brad gunned his motor. "You better say off the charts. Come with me, I'll show you cool." "You got hope." "I'll take you home, where me and Tiff hang out. No parents there to screw you around, know what I mean?" "Oh, man, do I ever. Is she there now?" "Yeah, waiting for me." "The old dudes. They might be in, but they don't give a shit. It's just like a few blocks away." Anne thought for a moment, then shook her head. "Forget it. I got a friend waiting." "What's your problem? Afraid of a little ride? Afraid of a little tiff?" "Oh, please. So show me." Anne studied him, didn't move, didn't speak. "Come on, I'll take you to your friends after in like an hour." She shrugged and said, "Sure," and hopped on. They roared off. Fran cruised her neighborhood beyond in her small beater car, her environmental statement, fuel-efficient, standard shift, next car would be an EV, or maybe no car. She hadn't cleaned out little putt-putt for years. The Anne's name for it, back in the good old toddler days. The ashtray reeked, full of so many deeply inhaled delicious puffs. Into her cell phone she said, "It's been an hour and a half, Ralph, and I'm coming up empty. She's not with any friends, not hanging anywhere usual. I'm calling the police. They won't do anything this early on. And she's jimmied her phone, so we can't track her. I know the cops can, or I hope they can, but give it a few more hours, until after midnight. I'll go crazy by dark. By then I'll be, welcome to my world. So sorry you missed last time, hey? I still can't believe you didn't call me, and I can't believe you can be so cruel now. Will you ever get in enough kicks?" A long, uncomfortable silence ensued. Finally, Ralph said, "Yeah, we got to keep it together. I learned from last time that she's pretty safety conscious, not stupid about taking risks, and her friends are the key, friends of friends. She's got quite a network. A 13-year-old running off to a party house and zoning out for 2 days isn't risk-taking? Of course, but she's smart, like you, Fran. She's got a good sixth sense. Likes trouble, but dodges the worst. Thanks, I think. Trust me, she's somewhere with friends, acquaintances. She's in the neighborhood. Let's hope. I'll keep cruising. We'll call you in 5 or 10. On a kitchen calendar featuring bank-issue sunset photos, Fran crossed off day one of the Anne missing with a heavy black X. The police were on the lookout, but given that the Anne had gone AWOL before, the time for any kind of public alert about this walkabout was days off yet. They wouldn't say how many. After 2 big X's on the calendar, dark circles puffed under Fran's sleep-deprived eyes. 3 midnight-to-dawn thrashings added another X to February and 10 years to her face. Tears fell as easily as she breathed. She drove and drove and drove around, even venturing once as far as the underage prostitute stroll. She checked malls and other shops, as did Ralph, midst his busy office and family life. During the long days, Fran drank endless coffee and cursed her phone. "Talk to me, damn you!" Then she cursed more at every incoming ring and ping that wasn't the one and only thing she needed. Ralph checked in often, and the Anne's friends called occasionally, jangling her nerves with high hopes. Every "no news, you okay?" call plunged her deeper into disappointment and frustration. After 5 big X's covered the 3rd week of February, a casserole from Cindy went untasted in the fridge. "She's a sweet woman," Fran said to Ralph when he delivered it, then bit her tongue to keep from making petty comments about, well, whatever snarky thought about Cindy that might leap out. Just not Fran's favorite person, even when receiving a very nice, thoughtful favor from her. Ralph smiled faintly at her compliment, his face muscles exhausted from days of clenching his jaw and swallowing the big hurting lump in his throat. Day 6, afternoon 6, brought a police car cruising up to park in front of Fran's townhouse. Her heart leapt. They traced her. They've got her. Please, please, please. But no. A burly officer unfolded himself from the car and walked somberly to her door, carrying a business-size envelope. "Oh, God," Fran muttered. "No, no, no, not that." Dreading the worst. When he was steps from the door, she steeled herself and opened it to him. "Miss Roma, ma'am?" He took long, unbearable seconds, then slowly said, "We need your signature to put up missing person posters, starting day after tomorrow." Fran felt relieved and even more desperate. The Anne wasn't dead. The Anne must be fine. She had to be fine. Dear God, when would this hell end? "Just a sec," she said. "I'll get a pen." "Got one here, ma'am." He took a cheap ballpoint from a breast pocket, then took the permit from the envelope. "I guess this means you still don't have anything, no leads, clues, nothing." She signed the permit against the door frame. As she handed the pen back, he said, "Kids usually show up after a few days." "Yeah, but my girl hasn't." "So we try this. Sometimes getting word out helps, sometimes not. You haven't broadcast this on social media, have you?" "No, I took your advice," Fran said. "Good. That route just advertises there's an acting out vulnerable kid on the loose. Don't want to alert the pervs." "Yeah, thanks for that," Fran said. He smiled, thinking she meant the good advice, missing how hard the word pervs hit her, bringing up images of smarmy, soulless predators. No, 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 not having those thoughts again for the umpteenth time. He continued, while sliding the signed permit into the envelope. "Kids mostly get found when they want to get found, and most of them do. Most, like most, get found, and then there's the rest. What about them?" He chatted on. "Supposed to call you in to do the paperwork, but, well, thought I'd save you a trip. Police stations can be hard to take times like this." Fran softened a little. "Thanks, I appreciate it." "Is she smart?" "As a whip." "Good. She'll be fine, or I haven't seen it all. Afternoon, ma'am." As he drove off, Fran hung on his every parting word. Yeah, she'll be fine, and Fran would be too if she had a big guy like that to hang on to until they got to the happy ending, and maybe ever after too, just because it would feel so good to be with a salt-of-the-earth, rock-solid partner. On the afternoon of the 7th day, another police car pulled up in front of Fran's place, this time with a policeman driving, a female officer in the front seat, and the Anne, riding in the back? Yes! The female officer opened the car door for the Anne, who stepped out wearing the same clothing she'd run away in. The officer escorted her toward Fran, who stood grinning and crying at her front door. "Oh, baby," she sang out, ready to envelop the Anne in welcoming arms. The officer held Fran back. "Please, don't. Her request." "Where did you find her?" "A few blocks away, small-time drug house biker boyfriend." Fran's eyes widened, mouth dropped. She whispered, "Biker boyfriend?" The Anne slipped into the house and went directly upstairs to her bedroom. The officer said, "I'm with undercover drugs. We found a small grow-up and some street kids. She seems to be fine, clean, coherent, no hard stuff, and we don't suspect attempted recruitment into prostitution at this point. No unwilling confinement, nothing like that." In shock, Fran muttered, "A week with a biker boyfriend?" She had no possessions with her that we could ascertain beyond her cell phone and what she's wearing. "We'll be following up and contacting you as necessary. Here's my card. Call any time." Fran took the card. "Thank you. Thank you so much." "Welcome, ma'am." Fran went inside and closed the door, then slowly slumped against it, unable to move or even think of what to do next. The pendulum of a nearby cuckoo clock tick-tocked noisily. Just as a talking crow popped out and said five times, the doorbell rang. Fran jumped and quickly tried to wipe some reality back into her face. She opened the door to Nora, Larry's assistant, who took in Fran's appearance and said, "Oh dear, I shouldn't have. I'm so sorry to disturb you." Fran collected her wits. "No, it's okay. It's been a rough week, but things are, well, they're looking up. I debated about stopping by and surprising you like this, but I'm just so worried." "You heard about the Anne? I haven't talked with Larry unless Ralph." "Oh no, I haven't heard. What happened? Is she all right?" "She's home now. Yeah, she's going to be okay." "Oh dear, I'm so sorry." Nora stepped back and turned to go. "I really shouldn't have stopped by. I'll call you, or you call me when things are..." "No, wait. You're here. It must be important." "It'll keep." "No, tell me, please, or I'll worry." "It's just Mr. Singer. He's having a little health trouble, but we'll talk later, and please, please don't tell him that I came by." "Larry's sick? I've been so distracted, so out of it, I..." "Don't fuss, don't worry." Nora put her forefinger to her lips. "And mum's the word. We'll talk soon. You look after yourself and your girl. Good luck." "Thanks, bye." Fran walked slowly, heavily, to the Anne's bedroom. She tapped on the door, waited a second, then peeked into the poster-lined, clothing-strewn mess just as the Anne had left it. The room had not one childish thing in it from her other home except her shabby stuffed rabbit, which she held in her arms. Fran walked in and sat on the end of the bed. A minute passed. Two. They looked everywhere but at each other. Finally, Fran dared to ask softly, "Who is this guy to you, the Anne?" "Nobody." "He can't be nobody. You spent a week with him." The Anne didn't answer. "What kind of tests do we have to do?" "Pregnancy? STDs? Nothing, man. Get out of my face, all right?" "I'm serious, sweetheart. Things like this don't just go away. There's nothing to test, nothing like you're thinking." "Really? God, I hope it's true. I mean, should I drop it or ask you right out if you're still a virgin?" "That is so crude and so rude. Why don't you believe me for once? You're so out of it, so off in your little fantasies." "So tell me what happened. A week with a biker sets alarm bells ringing." "Anna's sister Tiffany, who's studying for the convent, right?" The Anne rolled her eyes and groaned. "Can we just drop it? Tiffany's cool and Brad's like a loser, all right? I'm okay, just like I left here. Why can't you trust me?" Slowly, Fran said, "Trust. That's what it comes down to, doesn't it?" The Anne ran the bunny's ear down her cheek, as she'd done to comfort herself since toddler days. Fran resisted the powerful urge to hug her, to ease both of their two big, bruised hearts. After a long pause, she said, "Where do we go from here? I mean, separate from the cops and legal things and whatever they might want from you. No way, I'm not talking to them, or to you, or to anyone." "You might not have a choice. A counselor, though, that's an option. Separate from me and your dad, totally confidential." "No counselors, nothing, nobody here. It's like nothing, and it's over." Fran reluctantly agreed. "I guess so." More silence passed, and Fran said, "Maybe I'm stupid to ask, but, oh hell, if we're going to start where we left off, because I believe you that nothing happened, then why not? What about Oregon? Angela, still want to see her?" Deanne shrugged. "Will you go if I book it?" "You don't want to go. Not without you." "Really?" "You bet. What's Grandpa's first rule?" "Always call a bluff. But he's crazy." Fran smiled. "So?" Fran rang the front doorbell of a middle-class home in a Portland suburb. Cherry trees burst with blossoms throughout the neighborhood. She and Deanne waited briefly. A plump African-American woman in stretch slacks and striped T-shirt opened the door and welcomed them in, her voice soft and kind. In the living room, Angela sat on a cushion by a low coffee table playing Chinese checkers with her Korean-born uncle and 10-year-old cousin, a girl who was an attractive mix of her parents' coloring and features. The uncle stood up to shake Fran's hand. "Welcome. You were a name in our household even before you found Angela." He shook the aunt's hand. "Now you're a star here, too, like your mom." The aunt smiled shyly. Fran grinned her thanks and looked at Angela, saying, "Hello, sunshine, it's so good to see you." Angela nodded, her eyes stuck on the Anne. Fran said, "Angela, meet the Anne in person." The Anne's eyes twinkled as she said awkwardly, "Hi." The aunt said to the Anne, "And this is Joanne. We've got another girl sleeping. She's 3, and our boy's over at a friend's place. He's 12. Fran asked Angela, "What are your other cousins' names?" Angela lisped through missing front teeth, "Sarah and Alex." In a Portland hotel room, Fran draped over an easy chair while flipping through TV channels. The Anne bounced on the nearest of 2 double beds. "Please, Mom, please, please, can I stay, please? She's so cute and fun." "No, sweetheart, I've got to get back and talk to Larry about his health, find out what he's hiding from me." "So you can go. Mrs. C said I could stay just another week." "Okay, okay, they're really nice and you don't, like, have to be here." "Are you dismissing your old mom?" "Luckily, they are pretty nice. No motorbikes." "Mom!" "And I guess we could get some more schoolwork sent out for you." "Please, please, please." "What is it about Angela?" "I don't know. She's like a little sister, like sort of a puppy friend, you know. She's mad at Joanne and her stupid counselor, too, so I can talk to her." "What's she mad about?" "Joanne's mean to her, and her counselor's meaner." "Really? In what ways?" "Joanne's jealous and snitches all the time. And the counselor makes Angela tell her things, forces her to talk about her dreams, and gets all weird about it." "She's a bitch, Mom. You should talk with her." "Wow, I think I'll have to if she'll see me tomorrow before I go. Maybe I can get something for the file from her. Angela certainly hasn't opened up to me. Not that we've had much chance. So, can I stay, huh? Huh? Just say yes." "Well, I'll talk with the Chos and make sure they've got enough of your favorite monkey chow." "Yes!" The counselor's office overflowed with colorful, comfortable furnishings, big pillows, and bright Rorschach-type paintings. Thank you cards, small gifts, and testimonials filled every surface. 2 black-framed certificates hung austerely on a side wall. A middle-aged woman in a Swiss-inspired blouse and dirndl skirt leapt up from her desk to greet Fran. The former flower child had grown matronly in figure with long gray hair pinned up messily, a style doubtless comely in her prime. She darted her hand out to shake Fran's, her mouth tense. Her voice, however, was butterscotch. "Come in, please. I'm Serena Allen Sanchez." "Fran Roma, thank you for fitting me in." "You're welcome. Have a chair. Let's get comfortable." Serena returned to sit behind her large desk laden with dozens of family photos and children's handicrafts. She took a deep, calming breath. Fran settled, as indicated, and began. "My daughter, the Anne, will be staying with the Chos this coming week." "Yes, I've heard. Angela's very happy with the Anne." Fran smiled. They hit it right off from the Anne's first phone call, and it just keeps going. It's a bit of a surprise both ways, given their age difference, plus Angela's pretty quiet, while my girl's a constant scene ready to happen. "Angela's quiet," Serena said, "but far from shy. In fact, she's one of the most determined little girls I've ever met." "That's quite common in shy people, what some call a stubborn streak. I don't know what you've come to hear from me, but I really can only speak in generalities. We work in the strictest of confidence, and there's a lot that even the Chos don't know." "Well, that's the thing," Fran said. "I understand, absolutely, and I respect the necessity and legalities of this. But the Anne has heard some things, snippets of what's going on here, that make me think I'd better get a heads up from the source." Serena stiffened. "Oh, what kind of things?" "Process more than anything. Tactics for getting Angela to reveal her dreams." Serena tightened. "I work from the broadest base of training and experience, with dream therapy as the cornerstone of my practice. Angela is, as I've said, very determined, very resistant. I use a variety of strategies to overcome this." Word from the Anne is that Angela doesn't like some of the interpretations you give her dreams. Voice rising, Serena asks, such as? Making them appear darker and more nefarious than they are. You realize the seriousness of what you're impugning. Fran smiled. I don't realize anything at this point, except that I hope you can fill me in a bit, set the record straight. Serena looked a little rattled, her eyes restless, as she considered her options. After a couple of conscious breaths, she leaned forward and said, Can I trust you to not say a word beyond these walls? I mean, you're a reporter and all. If you recall, I'm the reporter who kept Angela from a media feeding frenzy after I found her, and I pleaded on my sign-off broadcast for the world to give her the privacy she needs to realize her sweetest dreams. And by sign-off, I mean that I quit being a reporter for as long as I can foresee. The thing right now is these not-so-sweet dreams, and I'm worried about them, and absolutely not as a journalist, but as someone who cares a lot about this amazing little girl. So listen, Serena said conspiratorially, I can tell you this much. She had troubles in her life well before the crash, dark and nefarious behaviors, as you so nicely put it, within her family. What? Some kind of abuse? Cult stuff? Satanic? How bad are we talking? Serena nodded and blinked anxiously. This is very difficult. She recites her experiences as, well, dreams basically mixed in with the present as a means of, she searched for words, of keeping her balance as she lets go of her formative reality. Nightmares, you mean? The aunt hasn't noticed anything like that, and they're sleeping in the same room, with Joanne, too, who'd make some fuss, I'm pretty sure. She's on to just about everything Angela does and says. Angela doesn't relate to them as nightmares. So maybe they're just dreams. Oh, please, they're very graphic, detailed, and immediate. Nothing a child could make up, any adult either, for that matter. Can you give me an example? No, Serena said quickly, jumpily. Strange things go on in them with elements of, what can I say? Evil. In her innocence, she's positive about them and possessive, too, which isn't entirely surprising, because they're her only connection to her lost grandmother, mother, and baby sister. And her father and brother? They also died in the crash. Well, yes, but Angela identifies almost exclusively with... No, I'd better not get into that. Listen, as far as the Anne is concerned, it's imperative that she not probe any of this, not make any kind of fuss or comments about it. It's far too dicey for any but a trained professional to deal with. And what do the Chos know about this? Very little. They've been wonderfully cooperative about leaving these aspects of Angela's former life with me, so as not to color or taint their present normal and healing environment, which Angela needs to thrive. You mustn't tell them anything I've said to you, or, well, the delicate balance we've forged could get upset with disastrous consequences. Angela's home life is working for her now, and I don't want anything to change that. I certainly agree there. As for what's working here or not, I don't have a clue, but I guess that's your business. Nothing goes beyond these doors, Scout's honor. Serena's eyes fluttered shut in relief. Thank you. I really can't say anything more, and I'm sorry, but my next appointment is... Her voice trailed off as she glanced at her Fitbit watch. Fran rose to go, extending her hand to shake. I'm booked too, flying out in a few hours. Thanks again. Serena's palm felt clammy. Poor woman, Fran thought. She's in quite a state over this. Poor Angela, too, working with such a high-strung confidant. But then, what did Fran know about counseling in general and in this particular situation? Only enough to tell the Anne to stay tuned and tread lightly. Goodbye, then, Serena said, squaring her shoulders and forcing a smile, as she saw Fran out her office door. Bon voyage. Ralph paced his office with heavy heels, nostrils flaring. One hand pasted his phone to his ear, the other waved freely to punctuate his words. So, you dumped her in Oregon. I can't believe you sometimes. Give me a break, damn it. I'm worried sick. I don't like her so far away. He listened for a moment, then conceded angrily. Yeah, better to have a 6-year-old puppy friend than an 18-year-old biker. But it's a long flight, and she's got to come home by herself. God knows what'll happen or how she could get waylaid. He slumped into the chair behind his desk. It's not a question of trusting her. I do trust her as best I can. It's you I don't trust. You're a flake. You're all over the board. Okay, have it your way. Haven't you all along? This better turn out 100%, let me tell you, or I'll... Well, just you wait and see. Eclectic clutter filled Fran's living room, all carefully chosen and displayed. In every direction, oddball items and clever details caught the eye and tickled the brain. Fran called it her open storage museum, her live-in landfill site. Mrs. Ralph Roma sat primly in this living room on the edge of an Algerian sofa piled with big soft pillows. She refused to let her eyes light on any item in the room. When they drifted to an unusual object, she quickly pulled them back to adjust her diamond engagement ring, centering the large stone on her finger. She studied her perfect white-tipped fingernails and picked pieces of imaginary lint from her three-piece polka-dot ensemble. Fran could tell endless stories about the very real-looking Amazon shrunken head, the eagle feather gift from Gixan friends, the original Picasso bum sketch, the sad donkey painted on a bracket fungus, the first edition of Captain Cook's Voyages, once proudly the only cookbooks in her house, except for Julia Child's signed copy slopped with oyster juice by the great chef herself when she and Fran, but forget the story, Cindy had never been interested and definitely was not now. She'd called ahead to ask for this emergency meeting, thus giving Fran all of 10 minutes to get ready. Fran put coffee and cookies preparation ahead of changing from workday khakis into her seldom-worn version of polka-dot afternoon drop-in attire. Looking like a plumber, she poured from a shining silver coffee service into fine china cups atop a rosewood tea wagon, the only part of the scene that suited Cindy's taste. "The casserole was great," Fran said warmly. "I froze half for the aunt to have when she's home. Thank you so much." "You're welcome. I put an extra prayer into every bite, and I know that made all the difference." Fran took a candy cigarette from a package. "Do you mind? I thought you'd quit." "I did, but not the fiddling part. It's candy. Want one?" "Oh, no, never smoked, never will. Never even tried one of those." Fran chewed off the pink, lit end of her now-worst habit and sat down in a rattan chair opposite Cindy. "Cindy," said Ralph, "is so upset. I just had to see you. I can't pussyfoot around this, so I'll just say it straight out. How could you leave that beautiful girl in a strange city, especially after she just... Well, I'm afraid I just don't understand." "Exactly. Ralph's not getting it either. This is the best thing for her, believe me. This is hard for me, you know. I mean, I have to deal with Ralph, and he's taking a lot of tranquilizers, way too many. And I'm packing on weight from all these smoke-free sugar highs, so sign us up for Junkies Anon, separate groups, please. What can I say? He's your husband. I can't help you deal with him. I'm sorry." "No, but you could help with the situation, which is in your own best interest as well. The thing is, well, you won't like this, but, well, he's talking about applying for sole custody." "He's what?" Fran exclaimed. "Sole custody, Fran. I don't know how it works, except he wants the Anne living full-time with us. And I'm not sure if that's what we need, especially if you're going to be in town more, so the Anne could be over here. If you'd just be more strict and reliable." Fran sighed in frustration. "Oh, God." Cindy shot her a condemning look. "Swearing is another problem, Fran, and you might think it's minor, but taking the Lord's name in vain is... I'm praying, believe me." Cindy straightened her diamond ring again. "In our house, we can watch what she says, and that's important because we have two very impressionable little boys who are learning bad things from their big sister. We need to get control of the situation. That's what Ralph says. Complete control." Fran said, "Two things you need to know and tell Ralph. One, I'm doing all I can for the Anne, with her best interest totally in mind. And two, she's all right, lots of sturdy good stuff in her, and she's going to turn out just fine. Keeping her from me, keeping her from staying here, isn't the answer. Nowhere near what she needs. Complete control will be a complete disaster. But the thing is, she's not staying here, not right now, and she's not at home, and poor Ralph's in knots," Fran interrupted. "At this moment, she's perfectly safe and fine. Ralph knows that. He talks to her every day. As for his knots, give him some more tranquilizers with a whiskey kicker. He can detox when she's safely home. And she will be. Trust me. Trust the Anne. That's what it's all about. God is the one and only I trust. The Holy Trinity. God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. And Ralph's my angel, my wise man. High praise. I had a rebellious time in my life, too, you know. I was older than the Anne, but I was swearing and dressing like a tramp, looking for trouble. When Ralph noticed me, I was only half straightened out, and he talked to me and saved me from slipping back to my old wicked ways. We both let Jesus Christ into our hearts one weekend when we went off to, well, it's very personal, very private, hard to explain, Adultery always is, Fran thought, but held her tongue. Cindy continued, Now that I'm saved, truly saved, it's my duty to God to try to help others. When Deanne ran off both times, I just know God heard my prayers and brought her safely home. And now I'm praying every minute about this awful Oregon situation. Fran interrupted, It's not an awful situation, not even a situation. We know where she is, and we know she's fine. She's with a very nice, very conscientious family. She's a smart, capable kid, Fran's voice softened. You've done a lot of good things for her, and I really, really appreciate it. I know I do things different than you, Cindy, but we all have her very best interests at heart. Can you reassure Ralph of that? Cindy forced a hopeful smile. I'll try. She hesitated, then asked, Fran, would you pray with me? Fran's surprised silence was permission enough. Dear Lord God Almighty, Father of my personal Savior and great Creator, who made woman in her frailties the weaker vessel unto whom... Oh, Cindy, I'm sorry, Fran said, reaching to touch Cindy's arm. It's just not my style, not the way I... Cindy deflated noticeably. But it's prayer. It's not about this way or that. It's about God and His infinite mercy. I know, and you're so right. It's just that, well, prayers are different for different people. But listen, I have an idea. Would you sing for me? Maybe Amazing Grace? I would be most honored if you would. Cindy happily treated Fran to the best rendition of the old hymn since Joan Baez's voice had thrilled millions of the once lost, now found. Brava, Fran cheered after. What an incredible gift. Thank you, thank you. I'll book Carnegie Hall for you next weekend. What do you think? Primly, Cindy replied, No, I sing for God now, only God, and I'm a mum. That's work enough for any woman. Well, you're a lucky and talented one, and I'm glad you came to see me. After another cup of coffee and proud talk of her boy, Cindy left Fran's, restored to full inflation, not a speck of lint on any of her polka dots or in between. Fran walked quickly from noon sunlight into the midnight interior of the Hippodrome Theater. Before she could see the refurbished glory of the place, she smelled its whiff of history seeping from the walls. Gradually, gilded features spangled out from the darkness. She stepped carefully down a sloping aisle toward the softly lit stage, finding her way toward it past tiers of black empty seats. At center stage, a lanky, tow-headed man held court with a half-dozen actors, showing the nuanced gestures he expected of one of them. He appeared almost albino, with dark, simian-quick eyes. He saw Fran midway down the aisle and immediately announced, with a slight Dutch accent, "Okay, guys, now you're perfect. Practice for an hour so it sticks." He held up a hand with fingers widespread to Fran, whom everybody noticed now, and said, Give me 5 minutes, darling. Go to the bean shop next door and order me a shaking zombie latte. I'll be there in six. At Bean There Bar, Raoul and Fran perched on stools by a busy window drinking giant mugs of gussied-up Java. It's been crazy lately, Raoul, really tough. I don't know half of what's happening, and that includes with Larry. I've been trying to talk with him, especially about his health, but what do you know? Nothing, that's the problem. Nora's worried enough to drop hints, but she's too loyal to spill it. I figured I'd talk with you before I ambush Larry and demand to see his medical chart. Good plan. He's, well, let's put it this way. I'm worried, too. How worried? Very. I'm supposed to pretend nothing's happening. He figures no one will notice until he drops. Drops from what? I'm not supposed to tell, but what the hell? We're talking trench warfare, huh? Chemo, radiation... Fran whispered, Cancer? Oh, just don't say it. Don't ask what kind, either. It's bad enough without names and numbers. Fran's eyes filled with tears. Damn. She collected herself, then asked, Has he started treatment? Ha! If oodles of wishful thinking and mental banishment count. Poor guy. What's the price of delay? Big, I'm sure, but what do I know? I just love him. Listen to him. Try not to cry. Thank God he has you. What's his strategy other than denial? Raoul shrugged. More denial. I want to talk to him, Raoul. Any idea how I might broach the subject? Tell him he ran into me. Tell him I'm a bad actor. Tell him I'm worried sick. You think I dare? Someone's got to. Someone with brass and balls. Whew, I'll tape some on and do my best. Thank you. Raoul took a sip of coffee and winked at Fran over the rim. Just changed his mind, sweetheart, not anything else, in case he fancies you with the brass dangles. Larry spoke urgently into his phone on speaker. Fran, listen to this. Just in, that Nova Scotia fisherman's been murdered, the one who survived the whirlpool. He was tied up, beaten, and shot. Fran was back home where she took the call, lounging in her office chair. With each word, she sat further upright. Larry continued, "Nasty home invasion in a little outport where these things just don't happen. Only his kid's rock collection was rifled and a few taken. Any idea why?" "Not a clue. I mean, Santu's uncle Sid's got a pet rock, but..." "What do you mean, pet rock? He's got this nondescript pebble. Clutches it like a kid with his favorite marble. But you're talking murder, Larry. That's not about pebbles or rock collecting. That's got to be a diversion or, I don't know, something's out of sync about this." "Yeah, I guess. I'm sending you the link. No, I don't bother." "What?" "Print a copy. Bring it over. I'm in a hard copy, real people mood. Or is it urgent? Like, I have to read it right now?" "No. The aunt's still away, and I'm tired of eating lettuce over the sink. Come for supper tonight, tomorrow, you name it. Bring Raoul if you can. I ran into him." "Didn't he tell you?" "Yeah, he mentioned it. He's got rehearsals and more rehearsals. Forget him." "Sure, I can come tonight. Can I bring someone else? Someone you've got to meet?" "Nah, rather not. Not on such short notice. You can kidnap Raoul, though. He's a saint, putting up with us two old boring hacks, exponentially boring each other." "Martyr," Larry said. "I'm the saint. I really want to bring this other person. Is that too pushy?" "Way, Larry. 7 okay?" "7 what? O'clock? People coming with you? Courses expected? Just come. Whatever. Whomever. See ya." Candlelight danced over the new lush greenery in Fran's sunroom and the foursome at her dining table. She presided over a delicious spread that came, every bit, from catered boxes of Malaysian food. May's earlobes hung heavy with amethyst earrings like tiny grape clusters, her padded shoulders wide in a sequin-swirled sweatshirt. A gilded butterfly caught its feet in her biggest black wig. Nikos wore his usual light gray shirt and dark gray pants, with a blue tie bright as the Greek sky to dress up his driver's uniform. Larry, in jeans and jean shirt, relaxed now to the point that his dark-shadowed eyes looked ready to sleep. May and Fran watched him with concern. May asked, "Larry, do you have the sachet Maya gave you?" Larry pulled the little sack from under his shirt. "Of course. For luck." The scent had dissipated and was further lost in the smells of dinner. He took off the necklace and wiggled the small pebble inside with his fingers. "Complete with pet rock." He handed it to Fran. Fran felt it. "Everyone's got one around their necks. What's this new craze? I'm feeling left out." May reached into her gold purse hanging from the back of her chair and retrieved a larger rock like Sid's. She handed it to Fran. "This is mine, from the same place as Larry's. Nikos brought it to me." To Nikos, she said, "Why don't you tell Fran about it?" "I should?" Nikos asked doubtfully. "Yes, where it's from, what happened, how you got it." Nikos began reluctantly. "It's from Mount Parnassus. You know where that is, yes?" Fran nodded. "I've been there. I have just returned from Frisol." "Nikos' hometown," May added, "near Delphi." "The mountain shattered on this past February 12th, an hour and 7 minutes past midnight. A large piece broke into thousands of small pieces." "You recognize the date?" May asked Fran. "Only too well. Little Rock's miraculous survivals help me. I'm not very good at connecting this kind of dot to dot." "Me either," Nico said, smiling shyly at Fran. May said, "But you know what happened there, and to whom?" "I should give names?" he asked. May nodded. Nico's continued. "I drove Mrs. Solari and her daughter." Larry's eyes widened. "Maya Solari?" "Yes," May said. Larry asked, "How does she fit with all this?" "She died at Delphi. I told you that, dear. Nikos drove Maya and her daughter Alma there." She looked to Nikos to continue. "They stayed at my place in Hiso 2 days. Nobody saw them. Then Alma and I took her mother to Delphi before midnight of February 11th, becoming the 12th. We left Mrs. Solari alone there and drove back to my place. A little past 1 that morning, kaboom, lightning filled the sky. The houses shook with thunder. The next day they found a mark on the ground, like a nuclear blast shadow of it seemed too far-fetched to be saying." He continued, "By the caves of the oracles, Parnassus splintered into small pieces like this. A few of my Hiso friends, those who dared, collected some to ward off bad luck or maybe to bring good. Greeks are very superstitious. I brought one piece for Mrs. Singer Jones." Fran looked at the little rock in her hand. "I'm still not getting it. I mean, I get the possible connection, but ooh, it's a stretch, and I'm not superstitious at all." May said, "That's good. One should never jump to conclusions or build on received interpretations. Evidence is what you want. And keeping on with this file is what you should do." She reached to retrieve the rock from Fran. As May returned it to her purse, she said, "Now, may I have a little more of that lovely mango dish?" Fran served May. She took a small bite, savored it for a few seconds, then said, "Fran, I would like to tell you about how Larry and I are related, because he's going to inherit my house, which has a few files in it that are part of the one that you're working on." Larry snorted, "A few files, and the Pacific Ocean has a bit of water." To May, he said, "I still have questions about Maya, how she died, how this ties in with her injuries and activism." May spoke firmly, "My father and Larry's great-grandfather, bless them, were brothers." She smiled at Larry, who dared not protest. "This makes Larry and me first cousins twice removed, if you use the Scottish system, which I do. Later I will tell you why it's superior. To clearly understand lineage requires that you go back from the ground up, which means in this case going back to 1836, when Josiah Singer arrived in New York City from Belarus, or White Russia, as you know. He was in his early 20s, trained as a tailor. He arrived alone, although he had set sail in a small fleet of ships, one of which carried his fiancée and her family. Propriety, or perhaps just chance, dictated that he take a separate vessel. His ship made New York, but hers got swept up by a fierce storm to Brazil, where they landed and made lives for themselves there. He never saw her again, and it took several long years before he found out what happened to her ship. Lonely, hopeful years, as you might imagine. He devoted himself to his business, and not until his middle years did he consider another woman. He courted Alzina Elliott, a sympathetic, Christian-raised woman, who, at age 33, was well past any hope of marriage. The Elliott name was a proud heritage, dating back to the Pilgrim Fathers. For the love of Josiah, our Alzina converted to Judaism, unlike Larry's mother. No, that's later, we'll get to that. Nikos checked his watch. 10:20 p.m. May progressed slowly from the trials of Patriarch Josiah to the adventures of his son. At 10:30, Nikos discreetly glanced at his watch again. Fran noticed and caught Nikos's eye for an appreciative moment. At nearly 11 p.m., the genealogy lesson concluded. To Larry's relief, May left Solomon out of it. Abel was Larry's father. B was his Christian mother. And after a surprise elopement, they lived happily ever after. May concluded, another great family love story built on faith, not religion, with enough belief in each other to put all of their troubles behind them. Shalom and Amen. The next day at Fran's door, Nikos's warm hangdog eyes again met hers. She had answered it with jacket on and purse in hand ready to head out. "Hey, what a nice surprise," she said. Nikos looked at his wristwatch. "Time to get the Anne, yes?" "Yeah, our flight arrives in an hour and a half." "A gift for you," he said, his burly hand holding out a padded envelope for her, addressed in his heavy printing. "To say thank you." As she took it, she said, "How sweet. May I open it now?" "If you have time." "I do. I'm leaving early because I just can't wait." Fran opened the envelope, pulled out a wrap of tissue, and found within it a loop of square silver beads. From it hung tassels of silver, turquoise, and black beads. "It's beautiful." "Worry beads," he said, "from Olympos." He used the Greek pronunciation of Olympus. Fran laughed. "I need them, do I?" He shrugged, his eyes smiling bright. "Sometimes. We all do. Now maybe I'm being pushy, but I must also go to the airport. I could take you." "Really?" "I am getting samples. I do imports from Greece. I have a quick pickup, nothing to delay you." "Then why not, your car or mine? Hey, the wheeled ashtray is clean for my kid." "I will drive if you do not mind." "Mind? That'd be great. Is that your car?" She pointed to his metallic gray Fiat parked near her door. Nikos kept it beautifully polished, chrome glinting. He nodded. "Deanne's going to love this. Squire away. Thank you so much." Fran shook the worry beads to include them in her thank you, then looped them on her wrist. At the arrival's parking lot, Nikos put Deanne's big duffel bag and small carry-on in his trunk. As Fran made for the front seat, Deanne said, "Aw, no, Mom." Fran said, "What? You want the front?" "Yeah, I suppose." She looked at Nikos, going for the driver's door. "She's a brat, what can I say? But she's my brat, Class A. Front seat variety." "No, I want you in the back with me. I got, like, so much to tell you." "Aw," Fran said softly, "my queen of hearts. You mind, Nikos?" He shook his head, eyes merry. He drove, listening to Greek taverna music. The Anne bubbled to Fran. Angela told me stuff, totally awesome stuff, you won't believe it. Such as? She has these dreams, but kind of awake dreams, like things are really happening. And Fran said, you weren't supposed to get into any of that stuff with her. I didn't, Mom, not till last night. Man, that Serena quack, she's so out of it. I gotta tell you, but she paused, looking at Nikos. I don't know, maybe I should, like, wait and... No, I think it's okay, unless Nikos minds. Nikos? No response from him. She asked a little louder. Nikos, do you mind our chatter? He glanced back. Pardon? Is my music too loud? Not at all. I like it. Good. He moved his shoulders sensuously to the music. Spiros, Taverna, we dance, yes? Fran laughed. You bet. She held up her new beads for the Anne. See, no worries. He dances, we talk. So Angela told you something about dreams. It's so amazing, Mom. She sees so much and it's so cool. Like when Angela was alone in the jungle, she just dreamed until you found her and she was never afraid. She just knew she'd be okay. Wow. So she had this dream right in front of me. There was this lady doing things and talking, not doing anything to Angela at all, nothing. Angela just like watches. Who's the lady? No, you first got to know how it happened, because it's so hard for Angela to talk to me without guard dog Joanne always being right there. Joanne commandeered the top bunk. The Anne took the bottom bunk, and Angela slept on the floor on thick foam. The last night the Anne stayed, she got up past midnight to go to the bathroom, catching a foot in Angela's bedding on the way. Angela roused enough to turn over. The Anne made it to the bathroom, guided by a nightlight glowing from the electrical outlet. She closed the bathroom door and, when done, opened it to Angela standing in the doorframe, her eyes wide and glittery bright as if still dreaming. The Anne flinched. Angela nudged her back into the bathroom and shut the door. She uncurled her hand, revealing her small rock like Uncle Sid's. The Anne said to her mom, she squeezed the rock and kept dreaming right in front of me, her eyes wide open. It was kind of freaky. She said strange things, talking about turkey eggs and aphids and Parthenope, oh man. She said it easy as pie. Weird for a six-year-old, huh? Something about a parting kind of genetics anyway. Parthenogenetics? Yeah, that's it. Someone in her dreams was using all kinds of big words and weird science stuff. Angela was just saying them, telling me by talking along. No wonder the counselor's a little flipped out. Back in the bathroom, Angela's eyes grew more focused as she surfaced from her dream. She squeezed her eyes shut and held the rock hard, whispering through her lispy front teeth, "Don't go, don't go, she's going away." "Who is?" "The lady." "What lady?" "The one with the baby, but the baby's not there. She's with her grandma, and the lady's in her white coat, where she works at science stuff." "In a lab?" Angela nodded. "So when you hold the rock, you dream these people? Always the same people?" Angela nodded again. "That's so cool. Can I hold it?" "No," Angela said quickly, clutching the rock tightly. "It's a secret. You can't tell anyone." "Who else knows?" "Nobody. When I came here, Auntie and Uncle saw my rock, and they tried to get it out of my hand, so I hid it in Teddy. Don't tell anyone. Alex and Joanne and Sarah are mean. They'd steal it." "Does mean old Serena know?" Angela shook her head solemnly, her lips tight. "Do you tell her your dreams?" "Sometimes. I can't go home till I say something." "Then she freaks? She keeps asking me about the lady and the grandma and the baby and where they are and what they're wearing and doing. And there's an old lady, too. She died when I got the rock. She was really old." "Who are these people? Are they, like, scary sometimes?" Angela quickly shook her head. "They're nice, like you. I wish you could stay here. Nobody else understands. You won't tell, will you?" The Anne said to Fran, "I promised on my life." "So where did she get the rock?" "I told you, when the old lady died. Angela had it in her hand when you found her." Fran said, "Ooh, goosebumps. You know, when I saw her in the hospital, she held one or the other hand closed tight all the time, and I couldn't get her to unclench it. I figured it was a trauma thing, and I guess everyone else did too. When I held her little fist, that's exactly when I knew I had to come home for good. Powerful rock, hey, if that's what did it. So what do you think? Is this the most awesome thing to put in your file or what? I mean, first Uncle Sid, like you told me, and now Angela." "It's totally awesome, sweetheart, but no file entry. It's a secret, right?" The Anne sighed. "Yeah, I guess so. I really want to find out more. Can I go back at spring break?" "I don't think so. Your dad's talking Epcot or Barbados or something." "Ah, this summer then, please, please. What's this go-go-go stuff? What's wrong with stupid old home?" Nothing you'd understand. Fran burst into laughter. You're hilarious, kid. I'm so glad the circus is back in town. The aunt suppressed a grin, hit Fran's arm playfully, and said, Shut up. What? Nikos asked quickly. Too loud for you? He quickly turned down his stereo. No, it's great, Fran said. He turned it back up. Fran asked, Who's playing? The little Greek rock band. He looked back and winked. He had been listening. She smiled at him, their eyes connecting with the same spark as the evening before. The Anne missed it. She wrinkled her nose at the music and said, It's too weird. Fran hesitated outside Larry's office door. She glanced at Nora, who crossed her fingers. Fran took a breath and ventured in. Larry's desk groaned as ever with Randy's droppings. Larry slumped in his chair, eyes closed. Fran whispered, Lair? He opened his eyes, but otherwise didn't move. Fran, how nice. Nora tells me you have a little hole in your sked. Can we talk? Sure, grab a chair. I've got more on the Nova Scotia fisherman. He checked through his monitor, searching for the file he wanted. As Fran sat down, she muttered, Not about that. Larry continued, I called Cole Preston, the CBC guy who broke the story. But he won't disclose anything by phone, text, email, PM, nothing transmitted, only face-to-face. I said you'd arrange a meeting. You're doing my job. The guilt meter's rising. Larry smiled. Good, you owe me. I'll fly him down here, okay? Save you going there. From the little he said, I guess there's drugs involved, a little smuggling business. Not much for fish boats to chase in February, any time of year, fishing down the food chain. And there's big bucks and dope hard to trace through remote outports. He wouldn't say anything about the kid's rock collection, why it was ransacked. Good place to hide stuff, you think? Could be. I'll check it out now, Lair. Listen, please. When I saw Raoul, we talked a bit about, hey, he opens in 3 weeks. I need a date. Will you come with me? Love to. Raoul tells me that he's always been good, but this time he's got some fairy godmother sprinkling fairy dust everywhere, doing wonders, or so he says. Bring the aunt. She'll like the production, although it's definitely PG. She'll like that better. How is she? Great. We're in the afterglow of a sweet time with Angela. Hey, the aunt's a sweet kid, a chocolate chip off the old spud. Two old spuds. She's way ahead of Ralph and me. I've never danced so fast in my life. Right now, however, I came to dance with you, and you're not cooperating. You look tired. I want to talk about it. Of course I'm tired. The big Gorgonzola won't override Boy Wonder and his stupid ideas. He just keeps telling him to crap in all my inboxes until some gems drop out. I'm trying to find a boulder in the basement to stuff him under, but even the lowlifes down there don't want him. Two things scare me about him. One, when he's in my office, and two, far worse, when he isn't. Look at this slag heap, and it's just a sampling of his spamming. It's all superficial process, not a whiff of content worth selling for manure. Fran concurred. Yeah, these damn top-down experts, with or without doting uncles. Telman doesn't know squat about what we do from the ground up, from the inside out. It's Ralph's kind of expertise, exactly what you're saying, all management. She made quotation marks with her hands. All process, no content. Hell, you can't separate the two like that. Larry said, I should do a piece, a huge feature, on the history of this separation of knowing the ropes from running the ship. Man, the chaos and incompetence it's wreaked on industry and government. What do you think? Fran said, great idea, but don't look at me. I'm out of the game and I've got too many opinions, too much bias. Now, can we talk about how you're doing? You're making this difficult, Larry. Difficult, Larry, that's me. The day I'm not, then you worry. You've cheered me up immensely, Fran. Got me thinking about a dynamite new frame-up that covers so many sectors. To hell with wading through this crap. Handing Fran the slip of paper, he said, Here, take Preston's number. Do what you can. Fran took it, leaned forward, and said urgently, Larry, I have to talk with you about your health. Larry checked his watch. Oh, damn. He hit a button on his phone. Nora, get me Randy, please. To Fran, he continued, Sorry, I'm late telling him he's an asshole. And I'm going to tell him about this new approach, as he'd call it. Give him the starring role as incompetent supreme. He'll be all twinkle toes about that. Larry, 5 minutes. Can you give me that much? Not now, but a whole lunch hour when Cole's here. I want to meet him. And book the 23rd. I'll be yours all evening, I promise. Fran gave up and rose to go. At the door, she asked, Mind if I bring Nikos to the play? Larry said into the phone, Yeah, Larry here. Wait a sec. He asked Fran, You two a number? Well, we gotta talk about this. We gotta talk, right? I ain't telling you nothing. As she disappeared behind the closing door, he said to her, Hey, you owe me an introduction fee. into the phone. He said, listen, I've got it solved. We've got to get you in front of the camera, starring role. No, I'm not kidding. As Fran emerged from Larry's office, Nora looked expectantly at her. Fran threw up her hands, saying, Larry is Larry. What can I say? Oh, dear. Exactly. I like this room a lot, Nico said, surveying Fran's living room. Better in daylight, more to see. Fran smiled. More junk, you mean? So you want to watch a movie, play cards, make fudge brownies? I would like to look a little here, if you do not mind. Sure. Nico's pointed to a semi-circular painting about a foot across at the top of a bookshelf. What is that? A fungus, believe it or not. A 70-year-old bracket fungus from upstate Vermont. Fran tiptoed to get it and handed it to Nikos. Its face bore a primitive oil painting of a sad donkey in a snowstorm looking through a window into a bright, warm house where a family at a festive table was enjoying a jolly feast. My great-aunt Ethel painted it when she was young. Fran gently turned it upside down. An old lady's trembly hand had signed and dated the bottom. I met her on her last legs, a frail old bird. I got her to sign it then. She'd given it to my mother as a Christmas gift when Mum was about 8. Some present for a kid, huh? Your Mum liked it? Treasured it. Aunt Ethel made a career of feeling left out and sorry for herself. I can see that. Mum took to this painting like a fish to water. She'd almost roast herself in the oven with the holiday turkey, then felt left out as we were carving and eating her. Where's your mother now? The big left out. She died years ago. I was 14, a year older than Deanne is now. She drank a bit, fell asleep in the garage with the car running. The insurance company didn't buy that it was an accident, but I don't know. Nikos let her talk, his eyes tender. Amazed at how readily she took to a kind ear, Fran continued. She left a letter for Dad, a sort of journal entry, a poetic letting go, I think, of her hopes for him, separate from her. Since she wasn't given to poetry, I guess a sudden attack of it didn't fit the actuarial tables. She didn't leave a note for me, no special goodbye, before I left for school that day, nothing. I turned 15 a couple of weeks later, and, I mean, what mother would do that, and just before her only kid's birthday? I still think she had a little extra vodka that morning, passed out waiting for the car to warm up, and just didn't make it to work that day. Oh, Fran, I am so sorry. I asked too much. Actually, Nikos, you're the first person who ever came into my house and asked at all. I'm really glad you did, if you're up to it, Nikos said warmly. I am. I like to know. Fran impulsively bust him on the cheek, then took the fungus and tiptoed it back to its shelf. Nikos helped her, taking her hand and holding it in his. He didn't try to pull her into a hug, nor did she fall into him and take one. After a long, sweet moment, she said, Now what? You hit the dreary jackpot right off. Pick again, try for a laugh. Or how about coffee and a kitchen tour? Nikos asked, Do you have something here from your father? Sucker for punishment, aren't you? He nodded and smiled. Fran turned to a seashell-encrusted side table and from the lower shelf picked up a small, finely woven ball made from dried grass. The lid of the ball fit so perfectly in size and design that it was only discernible as Fran lifted it. From inside she pulled curls of even more finely woven snakes, 9 total, one with 2 heads, which she put on the tabletop. They really do have basket weaving classes in the loony bin. My dad was the best, even won a few prizes. In-house, of course, nothing that hit the news. Nikos took the ball and studied it carefully. Fran continued, His family has a long history of dementia. Males only, shows up at about age 30, skips some generations. A lot of brilliance, too. Mum fell for the brilliance, didn't know about the insanity, but then she had her dark secrets, too. So I ended up with a lush and a nut for parents. Which, come to think of it, the Anne does too, except her dad's the lush and I'm the nut. Someone's got to fill the roles. Nikos chortled lightly. You are funny. And this is beautiful and full of snakes. 9 for the tripartite goddess. 3 times 3, 9 for the devil's number upside down. 9 for the arms of the menorah. 9 for half a golf course and his favorite club. Why not? And a mutant with 2 heads for magic and evil looking 2 ways for the god Janus and his own split mind. Where is your father now? Pennsylvania, on an Amish farm. Beachy Amish. They're less isolated than the strictest sects, although they keep to the old ways. They welcome Dad back to the fold because his grandparents came from there. His mom, my grandma, had moved there when she was a kid. By grade 8, she refused to drop out of school. That's the rule for Amish children, which caused a big uproar in her excommunication. She never talked about it. She became a nurse, married outside the church. Oh, it gets complicated, but what matters right now is that Dad's got a great home with some great people. Do you know much about the Amish? I've got some books and articles. Fran started scanning a nearby bookshelf. Nico said slowly, I would like to know, but first, how did you manage after your mother died? An aunt came to live with us. I got into the school newspaper, then broadcasting, and didn't surface until, well, now. You have made a good life from tragedy. And your father? He kept slipping and sliding. It didn't seem to worsen his condition, but by then he was pretty deep into his own world. She smiled. You should see him now. They've got horses and buggies and sleighs, and in the winter he rides hell-bent for leather on snowy, misty roads, a picture right out of 2 centuries ago. I do a little time travel with him once in a while. He's quite a character when you meet him in his own zone. Always call a bluff, that's his thing, and he's been calling bluffs until the Emperor's got no clothes, no shoes, no castle, no help, no nothing. Conspiracies everywhere, and damned if he isn't more or less right, except he goes too far, way too far. After a beat, she said, Now, enough about me and my parents, and I mean it. I want you to tell me something about yours. Nikos thought for a moment, then said, Tavli, backgammon, do you have a board? Of course, 2 or 3, maybe more. We can play, if you like. Fran pulled a foot-square box from a bookshelf and said, You know, I think I bought this one at Delphi. It's a replica of some ancient set. That is lucky for both of us. My father, he was very good, very fast. I will show you. Nico sat on the edge of the Algerian sofa and set up the game on a bentwood cedar box that served as a coffee table. Fran faced him from the sofa's matching hassock. He wowed her with fluid moves, obviously slowed down, so that she could be in the game. He told her a story from when he was too small to remember, his older brother Spiro's favorite tale. Their young mother got angry at their father about his tavli playing, a foolish pastime that made him late for meals. As time went by, he got worse. She tried everything she could think of to entice him home, to nag him out of his bad habit, to get his children to plead for their father's company. But Yorgos was a Greek man. He did as he pleased. And she was a Greek woman, determined to be a good wife, too proud to ask family or friends for help or advice. One day she grew so angry that she went to the local taverna full of smoking, coffee-drinking men. Only a brave or foolish woman would dare to go in. The men stopped talking, almost stopped breathing, as she walked to a game his father had just begun. She forced his partner to yield his seat to her, then won so quickly that he didn't know what happened. Nikos took the brakes off his playing and cleared the board at lightning speed. Fran giggled her amazement. Mother then asked father if he wanted to play a second game. He said no, that he lost because he was hungry. He would go home to eat and, when they returned, win against her. Everyone clapped and cheered as they left. My mother, Nico said, she never again went into the taverna except for the one night a year for women only. That does not count. She never again touched the game. She never again mentioned it. And my father never again came home late for a meal. With twinkling eyes and solemn voice, he concluded, In my family, we do not underestimate women. Fran laughed till tears ran. Or a master tavli player, you're beyond lucky. Sometimes. He pulled his worn, weary beads from his pocket and automatically flicked a few through his fingers. Today, I am. She came around to sit with him on the sofa and look at his beads. For a long time, they studied the little amber balls, each with its own hue and crystalline flaws. They slipped into examining each other's hands, life and heart lines, traces of injuries, flexibility, falling ever deeper into each other's warmth. With hands palm to palm to compare size, Fran asks, What's your home like? Big and beautiful while my wife lived. She was generous. She liked to party. She liked many people to enjoy her home. Without her, I could not. He took a breath. I sold our home, gave everything to friends and charities. I have a room at the back of my warehouse, very Spartan. I have a little place in Chryso that's much the same. No real home? Yes, he touched his heart. In here. Fran put her ear to his chest. A good solid one. I could dance to it. He laughed. She said, This is nice, isn't it? I mean, just sitting and talking and being here together. Of course, if the Anne wasn't upstairs in her room, this is enough. Fran burst into Larry's office, travel forms in hand. She set them in front of him and said, Larry, we're talking Nova Scotia. I'm going. What? Larry asked in surprise. A little getaway. She leaned closer and whispered, With Nikos. In her normal voice, she said, I'll interview Cole Preston, of course. What about your daughter, young lady? She's at her dad's this weekend, Cindy's birthday, big whoop. Ashley haven't told her about Nico's. No sense breaking the news to her in case the trip's a bust and there's nothing to tell. I don't know, you're asking me to aid and abet some serious midlife delinquency here. Yeah, so? Nikos has never been to the Maritimes, and a little outport snuggling could be very educational. I suppose there's only one way to test this snuggling hypothesis. Only one way, boss. Larry signed the forms and handed them back to Fran. He wouldn't let go, as he said, "It'll cost you a complete report." "Tit for tat," Fran replied, taking the papers. "I talk, you talk." Larry still didn't let go. "And then there's the little question of my introduction fee. The interest is rising daily." The Halifax Harbour stretches several miles from east to west, spanned by two bridges connecting its populous south and north shores. Ships of all types dock along extensive piers. The city's old waterfront is a tight collection of time-worn warehouses and wharf buildings turned into a tourist haven. Brick and cobbled streets run between them, with charming views around every corner. The air is rich with the smell of the sea, and 270-plus years of recorded seafaring history lively with heroics, horrors, and ghosts. At Nikos's insistence, Fran had rented a modest hotel room, waste not, want not, a short walk to the waterfront and historic properties. They checked in, dropped their luggage in their room, then left to drive to Peggy's Cove with Cole Preston. Peggy's Cove's outcrop of fishing village and tourist buildings, overseen by its iconic lighthouse, sit picturesquely on wind-whipped rocks. Nikos got out to walk and nose around. Fran and Cole drove 20 minutes southwest to a remote, barren beach. An icy, stinging blow pasted their coats hard against them and carried their voices away. Cole led the way to the water's edge, then walked parallel to it. He continually looked warily around for spies. Fran shouted, "I don't understand your paranoia," Cole shouted back. "This is dangerous ground, wide open like this. Better if we'd stayed in Halifax." "Sorry, I wanted to see where Jerry surfaced to get some perspective from here." Cole stopped to check up and down the beach, then leaned close to Fran to say, "Okay, it's like this. Jerry McMahon was close to cracking. He hallucinated like crazy after his survival, and he made extensive notes on his computer. He told me some of his wacko thoughts. They were some weird. I figure the big guys got pissed off with his ramblings and wasted him. Who are these big guys? I don't know, and I want to keep it that way. I've got little kids, Fran. The less I know, the better. He never said a word to me about the heavies or how he was making ends meet. But you know now, right? How'd you figure out?" "I got a thumb drive from Jerry's kid." Cole huddled closer to Fran. "The killers torched his computer and external hard drive. Nothing left. Everything he wrote was on them, as far as they knew. Nothing elsewhere in the cloud. Then I get this thumb drive from Jerry's teenage son, full of his dad's weird writings and a little file on the side that's different, scary different. It spells things out way too clear. Why does kid have that?" "He found it mixed up in a mess of clothes on his bedroom floor. The details the murderers missed on their rampage. It had some pirated music on it, plus this stuff for Jerry's. The kid passed it on to me."
So let's back up a bit. What was Jerry hallucinating about? He was cracking up, like I said, on about some strange women and science research, energizing explosions, sacred sites, geology, all kinds of freaky stuff. Related to the rock? Cole narrowed his eyes. "What do you mean?" "The little rock that precipitated his dreams." Cole stopped in his tracks. "How do you know?"
"I don't know anything. I'm just taking, a New Age flyer on why the kid's rock collection was rifled and a few pebbles taken.
So what is this? I mean, Jerry's ramblings and dreams. Some weird new cult or something?"
"Yeah, something like that. It's out there. Don't worry. What you're saying, though, is that Jerry's ramblings and the rocks, plural, weren't in any way connected, right?"
Cole closed his eyes in relief and said, with forced certainty, "Yes."
"So what's with Jerry's rocks?"
His eyes opened and darted about as he struggled for words. I figure they were looking for anything that crackled. Pitch blende, uranium, hot slag. I mean, if they had a Geiger counter, I don't know.
Hot slag?"
Fran's voice rose in pitch. "Hot rocks?" Cole nodded quickly and drew in close to Fran. "It's all on the stick, file named NWD for Nuclear Waste Disposal." Jerry and his fishing buddies dropped bundles of hot stuff way out at sea, slag, pellets, canisters of plutonium, iridium. The file's got numbers, dates, payoffs, big money, all in secret offshore accounts. Fran's eyes popped. "Holy shit, woo, hot story." "No story, man. I'm no Deep Throat, no Woodward and Bernstein. So listen, I break it from the States. No connection to you, except as the reporter who covered Jerry's survival, and you're right out of the loop. Ha! Not with the murderers. They know I know more about Jerry's last trip in the Black Swan and his crazy babblings than anyone. I mean, talking to you right here, right now, could be the end of me. I'm sorry, Cole, really sorry. Most guys in your position would be dying to cover this." "That's just it. I'm not dying for any of it. First and foremost, you've got to understand, I'm a family man, a Black family man with deep roots here, hundreds of years, and yet my people are still just getting somewhere. I'm working for a lot more than just me, doing everything positive, no tempting those devils to smear me in some way with this, to shut me up, maybe permanently. None of this mess has anything to do with me, not where I come from or where I'm going." Fran nodded her understanding, then asked, "So what do you want? You've thrown the ball to me, and I can run with it, if you give me the memory stick or a copy. Oh, man, you can have it. It's stashed at work. Come on, let's go get it." Fran checked her watch. "Can't. We've got to pick up Nikos, then my evening's all booked. First thing tomorrow morning, is that okay?" "Sure, come to my office. I start at 7. Cole turned and retraced his steps, heading for his car in high gear. The rest of the afternoon and evening in Halifax belonged to Fran and Nikos. In their hotel room, she opened the door to unexpected room service, with the cart set with Retsina on ice, 2 wine glasses, Greek hors d'oeuvres, and a bouquet of daffodils. He tipped the server and Fran beamed. "Oh, Nikos, this is so nice." His eyes twinkled. "I think maybe you want a little snack, a little drink?" She laughed. "Big presumptions. I might just be here to discuss the weather with you, you know." He waved toward the window, facing a moody northern sky. "I order that, too, lots of it." She laughed again. "You are so sweet." In a low, intimate voice, she said, "And we're finally alone. No one with big ears upstairs, supposedly doing her homework." She moved easily into his arms, which he wrapped around her, pulling her into his sensuous hips. Kisses came tentatively and tenderly. Lovemaking took a slow, sweet time. "To maturity," she said after, clicking her full Retsina glass with Nikos's in a toast. "The hunger is as deep, but the dining is so much finer." From a harbor-front restaurant, Fran and Nikos sat by a wide window and watched night settle over the port's restless tides and trade. By fading view and brightening candlelight, they sipped and supped. Fran asked, "Did you really knock on doors at Peggy's Cove while I was out wandering with Cole?" Nikos nodded. "To do what? Ask for directions? Buy a coffee?" "Exactly. You are very clever." He kissed her hand. "And beautiful. Did you score some coffee?" "Good coffee. Good company." "What did you talk about?" "These people live by the sea, so I talk about what they know. I say, I'm Nikos from Greece. I come on a boat from Piraeus. We have a rough crossing, but we get our business done." Fran played along, her eyes dancing. "What business?" "What we sail to do. Important business. Lots of money." "Did you really come to North America as a sailor?" "Again, you guess so well." "What, on a cargo ship?" Nikos nodded. "Carrying what?" He shrugged. "We transfer goods." "No kidding. What kind of goods? Greek exports?" "Oh yes, you are very smart." "Manufactured goods? Produce? The beginnings of your little import business?" "More or less. We bring things. We leave a little between ports, too." "What do you mean, leave a little? As in dumping?" Nikos nodded. "The ship gets lighter." "Dumping what?" He leaned forward and lowered his voice. "It pollutes." "No way. You were on a ship dumping pollutants out in the deep water? You are surprised? What were you dumping? Really dangerous stuff?" "What does not belong in the ocean is dangerous, can be deadly." "But what? Illegal, you mean?" He nodded slightly. "I am sworn not to say." "Ah, so maybe toxic garbage or stuff like old warheads?" Nikos smiled, sphinx-like. "Could be. I see it go in the water." Come on, tell me, you were dumping nasty stuff, right? Maybe even nuclear waste. Nikos took Fran's hand. My dear, if we replayed this conversation, you would discover that I told you very little. I give only general information, and I say yes every time you second-guess me. See how quickly I find out what is on your mind? Like most people, you ask questions with the answer in them. Even the best reporters do it, maybe especially them. Fran pulled back, then laughed. You are the slyest devil I've ever met. I can't believe it. I sailed. We dumped our bilge on the way. The ship grew lighter. I saw it. You had me dumping nuclear waste at sea. Chagrined, Fran said, You're good. You're very good. I know everything about Peggy's Cove, except maybe Peggy, who may or may not have existed. I know what they do for work and play. I know what they worry about. I could write their newspaper now, a thick one. Greeks used to have neighborhood broadsheets, the polis, news and gossip. You know that, yes? Nothing escapes them. So is it true? Were they dumping hot stuff from Peggy's Cove? Nico smiled merrily. Yes, my darling. Fran groaned. Oh, no, you got me again. Nico said quietly. And you were right. Everyone is whispering and worried sick. None of them knew anything about the problem, this terrible business, until the boy found something in a file. They are afraid to tell anyone, to call the police and make bigger trouble. I'm amazed they talk to you. You are amazing. No, I just listen. I worry for them. Something must be done. The next morning, Fran took a taxi the couple of miles from her hotel to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation building, a great concrete block in South Halifax. A few minutes early, she reported to the front desk security clerk who buzzed Cole Preston. He came out in a flash to greet her, wearing his coat and looking as tense as she'd left him. Morning, Fran said. You got it? Shh, he whispered, then spoke up for the clerk to overhear. Come on, let's go for a walk. Sure. Hey, I've got some good news for you. Fog swaddled South Halifax streets, coming in from a long, narrow seaway. Cole said, pointing southeast. The Dingle's that way, just a bit of traffic, then some quiet walking. Dingle? Fran asked. Part of Sir Sanford Fleming's estate, the genius who gave us the world time zones. Wispy sea-level clouds dampened traffic noise. Fran and Cole were soon past the noisy roundabout and onto an upscale residential street, everything black, white, and gray. He slipped her a small brown envelope containing the thumb drive, the letters in it, too. She dropped it into her coat pocket. What letter? Came with the file. I didn't talk with the kid. He dropped it off for me at work late afternoon. I wasn't in. So it just turned up, and the letter makes clear that he's not going to talk to me about it. So scared, and doesn't want to smear his dad. He wants it investigated, but kept secret, too. Tough spot, poor kid. Well, he's trying to do the right thing. Good for him. I guess you didn't dare talk with anyone else at Peggy's Cove. His mom, maybe? Not a chance. Well, let me tell you something. Nikos talked with half the village, and she knows. Cole's eyebrows shot up. Fran continued. In fact, everyone there knows this dirty little secret. They're all worried and ashamed. None of them talking to the authorities, I'm pretty sure. Oh, God, Cole groaned. No, it's good news. A good spin on bad news, anyway, because there's safety in numbers. What'll the goons do now? Kill them all? They won't be shocked, either, when the cops or CIA start showing up and snooping around, after we've done the right thing with this little bombshell. There is no we. The only right thing for me is getting out. I've given my notice. In 2 weeks, I'm done, finished, walking totally away. So let's get this straight before you pack up and start over. Son finds file, reads incriminating material, sneaks it to you, doesn't want to talk. Whole town knows anyway, I get to the authorities, they investigate, and blow it all open. Something's funny here, something I'm missing or confuses me, but I can't think. And I'm not the one to crack it anyway. Now this letter, tell me about it, since I can't look at it here. Typed, inkjet printer, I clipped my name off the top of it, and I shredded the envelope, which was addressed to me, marked private. No one else. They walked a few paces before Fran said, You don't want this story, and funny thing is, I'm not going to chase it either. Cole looked surprised. How come? My hotshot days are over. I've got other stuff happening now. I'll just give it to my boss. He'll pass it on to, probably the CIA, as an anonymous drop-off at Media 8, which removes it from me and you, and this trip's right off the record. Good. The investigators are still going to want to talk with you. They might catch you on some details, then realize you know more than they're saying. The only connection is the kid saying he gave me the little stick. What little stick? I didn't get any hardware of any size. He paused. So it turns up in the States. What's that got to do with me? You know, down the road, when it's all settled, safe, and hits the news, you could be a star. You want to take some credit then? And admit I was lying? Not a chance. More like protecting yourself. I think the police and public will cut you a lot of slack. Cole, this takes courage, and there should be some rewards. I've seen the guts of this business, and I don't need the glory. I've got my eye on a shop across the harbor, sporting goods. I can equip my kids and their teams wholesale. My 5-year-old, he's going to be the next NHL star, a total hockey nut. And I'm going to be his proud old pop, no other heroics. Yay, Dad, she tapped her coat pocket containing the envelope. Thanks, Cole. You've done good work. Best of luck at the Blue Line. Silvery morning light flowed into Fran's home office window. She waltzed in, carrying her big coffee mug and singing, What a day for a daydream, ta-da-da-da-da. She looked fresh and beautiful in jeans, sweater, and silver worry bead bracelet. She made a phone call. Hi, Nora. Fran here. Yeah, I had a great weekend. Best time in ages. Big scoop, too. Hot as they come. Larry's gonna love it. He there? Fran paused. Her face dropped. Oh, God, no. What happened? Oh, damn. Tears welled up. She scribbled the address Nora gave her. Thanks. Yeah, I'll let you know. Bye. Fran hurried to the Johns Hopkins Oncology Center, a recently renewed and expanded facility renowned for its record of treatments and care. At the nursing station, an attendant pointed Fran toward Larry's room down a long corridor, light and bright with huge windows and gleaming floors. As Fran turned on her heel to go, she heard, 5 minutes max, no exceptions. She peeked into a private room where Larry sat half up in bed, his head bandaged and arms hooked up to several drips. His eyes were closed, his cheeks hollow, his skin almost gray. She tiptoed beside the bed. With eyes still shut, Larry smiled wanly. Fran? She tenderly took his hand. Yeah, it's me. How'd you know? Smells like trouble. Fran laughed. Timber zone, I hear. Larry struggled to open his eyes. So, I fell. You dance on a cleared desktop, you take that chance. Good. The cleared part, that is. It's all your fault. We're doing things my way, no. No content process schizophrenia. You inspired me. All right. She looked at the drips. What are they putting into you? Snips and snails and puppy dog tails. Chemo? Larry nodded. How's it feel? Goes in easy. Anything you want, you tell me. Work stuff, too. I can sit at your newly cleared desk and fake your job if you like. Thanks. You can help for sure, but I've got Santu lined up. Santu, fantastic. How'd you do that? Asked him. He said yes, and call May, okay? It's important. Okay, hang in there, big guy. Larry struggled to smile as he shut his eyes. Fran kissed him tenderly on a fevered cheek, then quietly withdrew. A telephone, only a telephone, claimed the top of Larry's desk, a barren field open to new possibilities. Sunlight poured in through the sky-high windows. Santu filled Larry's chair, impeccably suited in shades of teal. Fran sat opposite him. She asked, So what'd he do? Call you as he was keeling? No, just before. He got me 2 minutes off the plane from China, deep in jet buzz and desperate for sleep. He said that he couldn't hold off treatment much longer. It was either that or go home for a permanent nap. I thought I was dreaming, more like a nightmare. He told you? He said the C word? No, he made it sound like a rash of warts or something, and he was going for a swim in Compound W. He asked me if I'd take over while he was off doing a little medical sleuthing, something he could write a piece about. I said, forget about making everything work, just do the drugs. It had to be serious for him to ask, so my answer had to be yes, no questions asked. What'd you tell the thieves who stole you from us? I made up a dozen lies and excuses, then settled on the truth. They're not happy, but so what? An old friend needs me. Lucky us. You know, for a boss, you're my number one second choice. Santu smiled. Thanks. Larry wants you to help steer me straight and, I quote, keep a 10-foot pole out for the Randy. Fran laughed gladly. Where is RT, the RAT? Larry put him in front of the cameras, the head mug for some interactive thing with lightweight, no, fluff, celebrities. He's way down in Studio F working overtime with a bunch of Gen XYZ freaks, on an almost zero budget. Who knows, he might surprise us. Oh, he will surprise us. Studio F for Foul-Up, you watch. He's trouble on two legs with a pointy tail. I'll keep an eye on him. You're still off for, what, another week on the rock and roll file? How's it going? Sandhu, boss man, hang on to your seat. This is big, really big, and dangerous. You won't believe it. It'll have to go to the CIA, no question. As soon as they know, it'll be out of our hands. Sandhu leaned forward. Fran continued. The trick will be to get them to promise the exclusive once they've cracked it. It's all on a memory stick, one nasty little file, plus an accompanying letter. There's other stuff, a red herring that they don't need. It'll throw them off, but it fits my file, so I'm keeping it. So, spill it. Remember the Nova Scotia fisherman who survived the shipwreck same day as your uncle? He was murdered recently. Yeah, Larry told me. Said you went to check out something. You and some guy. Fran laughed. Yeah, some guy. Nikos was a big help. It looks like Jerry McMahon and his fishing buddies were into a little one-way drop-off business. Fran and Nikos lay naked on her rumpled bed, as comfortable together as two old slippers. She decorated the room in early Americana, from a jelly-covered night table to a small spinning wheel in one corner. The duvet cover was a handmade star-patterned quilt. The pulled drapes had the same stars, from big to small, dancing up the bottom half. A bedside clock radio said 2:49 p.m. Fran snuggled into Nikos, and they lay silently for a warm minute, two more. She traced her fingers over his swarthy, black-haired chest. He closed his eyes. After 10 sweet, drifting minutes, Nikos opened them and said, Larry says, call May, it is important. May says, go to Athens, she will buy our tickets. No Athens, forget it, Fran said, checking the clock. Now at 3:10. Oh, boy, she exclaimed, jumping up to gather her clothes strewn on the floor. I don't want the aunt to even guess this. I mean, she knows I think you're okay, but I've got to break it to her so she's cool with it and gives us some kind of blessing. Nikos jumped up too, pulling the bed together as he did. Fran straightened it from her side, then both quickly put arms and legs into underclothing, pants and shirts. Nikos said, May does not waste money or time. It must be important. And Larry wants me to go. I know. Just one long, exhausting weekend, I guess. One night in Chiso, maybe. That appeals. I don't know. Let me talk to the Anne. The Anne perched on a stool at the kitchen counter, watching Fran chop vegetables and add them to a steaming pot on the stove nearby. Fran said, I don't want to go. I don't want to leave you or Larry. I'm worried sick about him. The Anne grabbed a peeled carrot and crunched into it. He's getting treatment, and he wanted you to call May, right? I mean, duh, I wonder what he wants you to do. And I've got to go to the nut house anyway. No, you don't. I don't know where your dad gets off, splitting your month here down to the last Saturday and Sunday. It's Cindy. She'll do anything to get me to church every Sunday till we run out of Sundays. God, she's so obsessed. And it's okay this weekend, because you should do the Athens thing. She paused, crunching noisily, with Nikos. Fran's eyes jumped to the Anne's. What? Listen, for Dad and Cindy's sake, and well, to protect myself from too much shrieking and praying, I let on that Halifax was just you, but I know he went with you. I know it. Great. You've been singing like till, where's the off switch? So why not Athens? How'd you figure Halifax? He drove you to the airport, and he was all, you know, slicked up and whoa, aftershave, and that little play doctor bag in the trunk? Then there's all this singing? Fran laughed. You are so smart, and I am so dumb. You don't disapprove? No, I want you to go again. I want you to get out of here. I want to go to church with Cindy. Oh, man, Fran sighed despondently. You just don't get it, do you? I'm trying to arrange it so you'll be home more often, and you just don't get it. Huh? Are we switching languages now, or what? Pick one I know, okay? The aunt smiled disdainfully. With mock impatience, she explained. Nikos goes with you, right? He works in town. He can't take off all the time. So you keep hanging with him, and he keeps you here. Except for weekends. You can disappear then, because I'm stuck with Snow White and the dwarves anyway. You're matchmaking to keep me at home? Am I hearing you right? The Anne said defensively. I'm being practical. So, you like Nikos? I didn't say that. Oh, what are you saying? He's got big nails. Fran said slowly, Nikos has big nails. Which ones? Thumb, toe, little finger? No, dummy, big enough to nail your shoes to the floor. Fran burst into laughter. and a big damn schemer helping him. There goes the whole feminist revolution. What are you two plotting? He doesn't have a clue. Don't tell him either. Guys are, like, weird. They take off when they think you've got plans for them. But, I mean, why else keep them around? Fran belly laughed, barely able to say, Man, if I'd known what you do at 13. At night, the Acropolis in Athens is a floodlit fantasy of ruins, crowning a restless metropolis pushing hard into the high-tech future. On the mound's eastern embankment is the Odeon of Herodes Atticus, an amphitheater from nearly two millennia ago, restored to one of the world's great open-air performance venues. That March, it shone with unusual brightness, drawing crowds to a special presentation heralded by huge banners announcing in Greek and English, Tonight, world premiere of Sinolos by Alkis Limonos, 9 p.m. Inside, Fran and Nico sat on the restored stone seats that are around a small stage. They perched in a sea of many hundreds who filled the tiers to overflowing at the season's must-see and be-seen-at event. Many were coated or caped in velvets and furs. Starlight fought its way through the city haze, thick despite a cool spring breeze. Bunting marked with the Olympics' five-ring symbol reserved the best seats in the house. Athens was fitting the executive of the International Olympics Committee, renewed and reconfigured to keep this millennium of games on track. The favored few sat on purple and gold-trimmed cushions, served by a swirl of attendants. A small orchestra claimed the two left front rows. The first violinist started plinking a Chinese tune. From behind the stage's scarlet satin draperies, a Chinese gong sounded. The curtain gathered up, raising to reveal a backdrop of a classically painted Chinese mountainscape. Theatrical smoke billowed. A woman wearing a long white toga and golden diadem walked, almost floated, to center stage and waved an arm to stop the orchestra, which instantly complied. The audience's settling in sound stopped too. In profound silence, all eyes locked on her. She was middle-aged, beautiful, and decidedly Grecian in contrast to the Chinese theme. Nikos's jaw dropped. He dared not whisper to Fran that he knew her. If Alma was in danger of being shot on quiet, remote roads, then she was taking an unbelievable risk by appearing so boldly before such a high-profile public gathering. Muffled, confused sounds emanated from the wings of the stage. As the mist dissipated, the backdrop parted in the middle and slid to each side, revealing another backdrop, a landscape from Olympia, site of the original Olympics. A painted apple tree dominated the foreground, with plentiful red-gold fruit and one all-gold ball. A large snake wrapped itself on a branch, its head and split red tongue sticking out from the faux foliage. A graying, rotund man strode onto the stage, shouting in Greek, Stop! I won't have this! I don't care who you are! The audience gasped and muttered. Fran, like many others, heard the translation through earbuds Bluetooth to her smartphone. The woman on stage signaled to the orchestra to play a Greek folk tune, then waved the elderly fellow backstage. Over the light music, he shouted, Do you know who I am? The woman swept her arm toward the man and announced in Greek, Alkis Limonos, premier playwright and theatrical innovator. She led the audience in hearty applause. From behind the backdrop, 10 women joined her, each dressed in white togas. Then 4 men in athletic tunics of ancient design stepped forth. Alkis groaned, You've hijacked my cast. The woman said, From the second act, there will be no disruption of your great work, and we will take only minutes. Gaia must speak. The Earth, our mother, must speak. Alkis swept his arm toward the woman, as she had to him, and said to the crowd, My friends, first the cartoon, then the main feature. As he exited, laughter erupted. Gaia raised her arms and by her regal bearing quelled the audience. In a deeply compelling voice she said, 10 priestesses to represent the 50 of old, the 50 required to be the classic 100-eyed, 100-handed servant of creation and peace. The 10 priestesses sang a lament in Greek, a classic strophic chorus. 50 mouths laugh, 100 eyes cry, we serve eternally and never die. Gaia said, "In honor of Gaia and her long line of servants unending through the millennia, I proclaim these Olympic Games open." The chorus sang, "She passes, but is forever, living on, leaving never." Gaia bowed her head. "Let us pray." The cast sank to its knees. For a moment, all sound and motion stopped. In this deep silence, Gaia said, "Let us pray for the wisdom to open the games in the spirit of their inception. The ancients noted that the earth comes into alignment with the planet Venus's orbits around the sun, 13 of them for every 8 earth years, which they called a great year. 13, of course, is a sacred number, for the lunar cycles in a year matched by women's cycles. Contests were held then to select the ablest of men contending to serve Gaia and her nation, that he might show all his people how to engender families born of love and to live in harmony with each other and upon the earth. Gaia is the supreme Olympian's guide, his conduit to the spirit of all that's good and right with humankind and nature. Without him to serve and lead, lesser of his kind descend into greed, destruction, and war. The priestesses are her emissaries to bring wisdom and peace into every home. Every 8 years, however, was too long between Olympics, for humanity is restless, our attentions fickle, so Gaia halved the great year and held the contest every 4 years. In 1896, the world revived the 4-year Olympiad. In the centuries to come, we must revive the other most sacred purposes of the games, or they are a mockery. They are not Olympics and must not be called such. The opening ceremonies of each Olympics must make clear the history and purpose of the games. The closing ceremony must allow the life spirit, through the symbol and wisdom of eternal Gaia, to honor the athlete chosen, above all others, to dedicate his proven strengths to the promotion of peace among peoples and the care of the planet. 4 men mimed archery, discus throwing, the start of a foot race, and high jump. 3 then deferred to 1. He took the golden apple from the tree and stepped forward to present it to Gaia. She took it, blessing him with her other hand. The chorus chanted, "She lives forever, leaves us never." They retreated from the stage, their voices fading. "She is with us, she is with us, she is with us." Gaia circled both arms wide, then brought her hands together in prayer. She bowed while pointing her joined fingertips out to the audience. Then she spread her arms to send her prayer, hope, and blessing to them. The curtain came down. Everyone sat transfixed for a few silent, surreal seconds. Fran blinked herself to action, whispering urgently to Nikos, "Quick, before she gets away. This has to be why May sent me, us." She bounced up, pulling him in tow. As they scrambled out of the building to rush to the back of the Saina, the ancient massive stone edifice or scene behind the stage, the orchestra began its Chinese piece again. The gong sounded, the curtain rose, mist swirled. A dragon entered, followed by the actors wearing ornate Chinese costumes. They spoke in Greek with sing-song Chinese accents, their plaints drifting up into the Athens night sky. The Odeon of Herodes Atticus does not have a backstage, rather a wide, flagstone public plaza backing the Saina. For this performance, the plaza held a large, market-type tent to hold the many actors and props. If Gaia wasn't in them, then she'd have escaped onto pathways and narrow streets running east and west. The tent had 2 openings. Nico stood guard by one while Fran hurried to the other. To a security guard at the entry, she waved her all-purpose press pass. He let her go in without looking closer or questioning. Through low lighting and a hubbub of low voices from several dozen Sinolos cast and crew, she saw actors in togas and tunics changing into their main feature costumes. She asked one of them, "Where is Gaia?" She got a head shake. She asked the next and got a vague shrug. The third waved toward a door opposite the one she'd entered. Fran flew out at Tanikos, who had been watching in every direction for Gaia's white robes. He still had not told her that he had recognized Alma. Alkis appeared and hissed in Greek, "Who are you? What do you want?" Nikos whispered back, "We are looking for Gaia. She escaped before I could kill her. Are you with her?" "No," Nikos said. "This is Fran Roma, Media 8 News Service. She showed her press pass. Oh, no, Alkes groaned, then said under his breath, I don't need this. Franz said, it's the best publicity you could get, international coverage. I need to find out who Gaia is, how and why she did this. She's a great phantom of the theater. No one knows where she comes from or goes to. Actors die to work with her. She is Alma Solari. Alma Solari, are you sure? Alkes nodded. Fran turned to Nikos, her hushed voice rising. My God, Nikos, why didn't you tell me? Alkes said, shh, so you are friends, are you? Fran said, no, I don't know her from anyone, and her trail's getting cold as we talk. I just need to know where she went. Alkes reached into his pants pocket and retrieved a business card. He handed it to Fran, saying, here. She gave me this when she ran by me and escaped. She said to pass it on, but didn't say to whom. You keep it. Fran took the card and tried to make out what it said in the dim light. Minnesota, it says, Alkes growled. This is Athens. This is my play, my world premiere. Forget her and go watch it. Right about that. Quietly, Nikos said to Fran, he is right. We must go. Fran resisted. But the cast knows. I've got to talk to... Alkes insisted. Exo, out, before I have you thrown out. Fran said, so throw out the press. That's a good story, too. Alkes said, out, out. Fran and Nikos retreated outside to a streetlight where they read Alma's card. Pavla Blanka, PhD, Life Sciences and Interdisciplinary Studies, University of Minnesota, with May written on one corner. Fran and Nikos walked down the busy East Boulevard to the Plaka, a crazy district that clings to the north side of the Acropolis. On cobbled, single-lane streets, they raised their voices over the din of cars, music, and chatter from tavernas and souvenir stands. Fran said, you watched that whole little piece and you didn't tell me. I can't believe it. Nikos said, I was shocked. I did not know what to say or if I should say anything. I still do not know. She is always in danger. People want to kill her. She's not too shy about standing up in front of a big crowd, a lot of important people. And who are these killers? Why do they want to waste her? He whispered, I do not know. I do not know anything except that tonight she had something to say. It must matter enough to take the risk. And it matters enough to May to send us here. But then we can't connect with the very person I assume we're supposed to see. I don't get it. Maybe seeing is enough. You drove her all the way to Criso and she stayed at your place there. You must have talked. We had polite words. I do not ask her anything she does not tell. Fran sighed in frustration. So who's this Pavla Blanka? She held up her business card. Alma's daughter, I believe, but I have not met her. Fran flicked the card. Well, that fits, I guess. What, damn it, is May up to? Something very important, I am sure. But what? Who knows? I am just the driver. By bright morning light, Nikos and Fran sped in a rented car toward Criso from broad freeway to mountain highway. At noon, the first ruins of Delphi appeared up the winding road, a scattering of temples and tumbled stones on green plateaus midst craggy peaks. Fran said, hard to believe, 6 years since I was here. In some ways, it's like yesterday. In other ways, like a lifetime ago. How long did you stay? Just a day, one long day. I was covering some government uproar in Athens and started getting sick from the heat, the pollution, the whole scene, so I stole a day off. I felt great up here. I walked every square inch, memorizing every structure, every story. Nico smiled. Then you can tell me. I have forgotten so much. Uh-uh, you were born to this. You know it by heart, not by rote. Nothing equals that. Nikos reached to her hand. I am so glad we are here. He slowed down to pull into the main Delphi parking lot, which had room to spare in the off-season. Fran said, no, let's go right to Criso. I don't need to see where the old lady evaporated. No, I want to see the Omphalos for good luck. I want to be at the center of the universe with you. Fran smiled, then asked hesitantly, did you? Of course you brought your wife here. He shrugged and slowly said, that was then. This is now. At the navel stone, Nikos circled the chest-high rounded cone, gently touching its once-carved surface, chiseled down to repurpose it for Apollo worship, further worn for millennia of weathering and reverent human hands. He guided Fran's fingertips over it. As they held hands across it, he said, I did not think I would love like this again. I am so thankful. Fran smiled, beautiful in his eyes. She said, It's corny, you know, but I guess this is what belongs at the center of the universe. Love. I can't think of anything better. Greeks have words for 6 kinds of love, at least. Here's to all of them. Now get me out of here before I melt into a sappy puddle. Fran and Nico spent the evening at Apollo's Taverna, reveling into the darkest hours. Local men, women, and children crowded in to see Nikos and his new woman. Feasts of food and waterfalls of Retsina flowed. Live music pulsed. Singers soloed and chorused. In a line of Greek men, Nikos danced beautifully, daring to dance flirtatiously for his lady love. With his eyes and a flick of his head, he invited Fran to dance with him. She laughed while shyly hesitating. Another woman started walking his way, but he quickly broke ranks to reach for Fran's hand and pulled her gently to join him. The crowd raucously approved as Nikos led their dance. Spiro led the applause. Fran danced radiantly. 2 days later, Fran schlepped in sweats into her home office. Love jagged, she said to Nikos. We didn't have time to get jet-lagged. Through weary eyes, she called up file after file of Jerry's writings on her computer screen. She read aloud, quietly, slowly, taking in every word. The baby's a spitting image of the mother, exact same as her mother's baby pictures. I'd put money on that. And the mother's the perfect same as the grandmother. Anyone could tell just looking at them. They're like identical twins, only 25-30 years apart. Can't say as I like it. Spooks up my back a bit, but those are the facts. When I was down for the count, drowning for sure, I saw the old lady, the great-grandmother, and she's one of them, the exact same, though white-haired and wrinkled like all old folks, so it's harder to tell. The Anne quietly appeared at the open door. She clipped up her hair and sheened her cheeks and eyelids with fine glitter. She wore a short satin skirt, color-matched sweater, and tottery high heels. For a moment, she watched her mom, then said, No rest for the wicked. Fran jumped, but kept her eyes on the screen. The aunt continued, That's what Cindy says. Fran said, Believe me, I'd rather be doing nothing if it got me off the wicked hook. She looked up. Oh, wow, what's the occasion? A touch defiantly, the aunt said, I'm wearing this to Raoul's play. Turn around. Show me you can walk on those things. They're not your usual clunkers, you know. The aunt turned and took a few awkward steps. Nope, won't do. Walking lessons will commence in 2 minutes. When you can cross the room with the big Webster on your head, you get your driver's permit. So, can I wear this? Of course. I've got a spare gunny sack to cover you from neck to heels. Mom, it's fine. I'll go anywhere with you, with pride. Softly, she added, You're beautiful. Now go get the 2-ton dictionary. Meet me in the hall. The Anne left. She walked lightly, eyes sparkling. She sang quietly to herself, Beautiful, I am beautiful. In the foyer of the splendidly refurbished Hippodrome Theater, the Anne and party milled with the glitzy crowd. The Anne looked years older, with satin hips, heels, makeup, and sassy hair. Fran, Nikos, May, and Larry kept her under close guard. Larry wore a soft brown yarmulke on his completely bald head. It almost covered the red scar where he'd cracked his head on his desk when he fell in his office. He wore peach slacks and floral silk shirt on his thin frame, the color perking up his sallow complexion. He tied the outfit together with a brown belt and shoes. So I lost the bottom fringe, he joked, the monk look. Maybe I'll get a full head back as a bonus. Ask for pink cheeks, May said. Hair is an option. She sported a black beehive wig, sitting on straight, bejeweled with dozens of twist-in rhinestones. Her painted face, almost, but not quite, made her look like a tarted-up dried apple doll. She'd sheathed her old bones in a long indigo dress, the neck draped with a string of large, irregularly shaped amber beads, the centerpiece of which held a cretaceous mosquito. Her attire ended in her great-grandmother's gold-leather high-button boots from the gay 1890s, when gay only meant merry. Fran and Nikos wore tasteful togs, tailored blacks and grays, but nothing notable beside Lolita, Scarhead, and ancient doll. The Anne snapped a photograph of her party, then Fran recruited a nearby fellow to take a shot of all of them. The Anne's smile outshone her 4 chaperones' bright faces. Fran then discreetly showed Pavla Blanca's business card to May, pointing out her name handwritten on it. She said, I have to know. May whispered, Later, dear. I can understand why you said that to me on the phone, if wiretaps worry you, but I don't see any spies here. Please, I'm dying of curiosity. It's not spies. It's timing. I'm glad you're motivated. And spinning my wheels, I found out that Dr. Blank is on sabbatical, no forwarding address. Of course, if she was here, she wouldn't give out her card. But she didn't give it out. It's from Athens, via Alma, as you know. Why this wild goose chase? You must be patient. May turned and said, Nikos, shouldn't we be getting to our seats? Here, take my arm. Larry, you escort our two young ladies. Darkness and expectant silence fell over the sold-out theater crowd. The curtain rose. At the center of a black, otherwise empty stage stood a shadowy shape with a haloed face. A sudden, harsh, white spotlight manifested Maya. Oh, dear God, Larry gasped, leading the collective surprise of the crowd. She wore her navy dress, hose and shoes, blood bespattered. Her white hair was dirty and matted. A jagged, red-yellow wound ran down her face, where it had been slashed from forehead to chin, continuing down her neck. I appeared with my hair and face uncovered in public, Maya said, struggling to overcome great pain. I carried no note from a sponsoring male family member to allow me to be out at all. I joined women doing the same as they voted in a local election, while voting with their lives and freedom for these basic human dignities and rights. A zealot attacked me and others, abetted by the police, who took us to jail. I was flogged there, 12 lashes. After, I was removed to a private home to die without a trace. Others will languish and die in prison, and better that than being tried and sentenced to a torturous death or sent home to family zealots to finish them. All record of this protest was destroyed and all news was banned. This, she indicated her state, did not happen. A bearded mullah approached her, shrouded in black. She closed her eyes to steel herself. He unzipped the back of her dress and roughly pulled it off her shoulders down to her waist, revealing a dark slip underneath. He took a whip from his robes, turned her side view to the audience, and proceeded to flog her. A man stood up from a seat and shouted, "Stop it! Stop this insanity!" Other outraged audience members joined him. Through the rising chorus, the flogging continued. At the count of one dozen, Maya collapsed and the cleric disappeared into the shadows. A woman wearing a white toga came on the stage, ethereal under a golden spotlight. She looked stunningly like Gaia in Athens, only 20, 30 years younger. "Oh my God," Fran exclaimed, as shocked as Larry had been. The young woman held up both hands to quiet the crowd. To the hushed audience, she said, "Her name is Legion. It does not matter. She survived the flogging but died days later. They killed her. You are the first to know. At intermission in the lobby, there will be a petition to sign, hard copy or online, and a fundraiser to support, that we might gather forces to help women everywhere get free of such barbarity, to be full citizens under the International Bill of Rights for Women, formerly called the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW, created in 1979. In places where the Dark Ages continue to prevail, millions of women are oppressed and bullied, and those who defy are beaten or worse. We can shine a light on them to defeat the darkness and bring decency to the world. Thank you." The curtain dropped, the lights dimmed to black. The audience, as had the one in Athens, sat stunned and murmuring until a spotlight tracked Raoul onto the stage. His pale hair shone brightly in contrast to his black suit and shirt. "Our play tonight is a dark comedy about persecution of another sort entirely, but in the eyes of justice it's all the same. You have just witnessed the first and only record of the recent events leading to this old woman's death. Thank you for your unexpected participation and supportive reaction." Raoul led the crowd in applause, which started as a smattering until the man who'd shouted out before bellowed, "Freedom and justice for all!" The clapping went wild. Some people stood. Others joined them. Raoul's play started with a standing ovation. Later, it finished with one too, as satisfying as the first. After the play, Larry and his guests adjourned to his and Raoul's penthouse apartment, a fabulously whimsically appointed spread. Raoul, an interior decorator by avocation, filled the living room with stage props, trompe-l'oeil paintings, innovative trim, and oddball furnishings. Comfort wasn't a first, second, or third consideration, but there were seats enough for everyone. Larry went immediately to lie on a wide divan, a winged Art Deco fantasy, May perched in the curl of his torso and hips. Nikos and Fran found oddball 1950s-style wingback chairs. The Anne sunk into a stack of Afghani pillows, whispering, "Wow, oh, wow," at every detail. Raoul, pumped from his success, served wine and juice from one-of-a-kind stemware, each bent and bizarrely threaded with glass designs. When all had drinks, Fran raised her glass high. "To Raoul! What a risk! What a payoff!" May said, "Yes, to Raoul, to triumph." Raoul grinned, wonderfully abashed, high as a spring kite. All agreed and cheered enthusiastically. Larry said, "What a guy, even skips the cast party for me." "This is the party," Raoul quickly replied, just as his hip pocket phone rang. Into it he said, "Yes, fantastic, come on up." He soon opened the door and welcomed in Alma Solari, enveloping her in a bear hug. She had scrubbed back to her own age, but wore Maya's navy coat over clean navy dress, hose, and shoes. Fran's jaw dropped. Larry's eyes popped. The Anne blinked and shook her head. Nikos grinned. May pulled herself up, eyes happy with tears, and led the rest with a quick round of applause. Alma curtsied her pleasure. Raoul bowed and, with great flourish, introduced her. "Alma Solari, director extraordinaire. This is Fran Roma and Fran's daughter, the Anne." Alma smiled broadly as she shook Fran's hand. She then took both of the Anne's hands and looked admiringly at the whole of her, saying, "What a beautiful girl." The Anne beamed shyly. "You have good presence, power. Use it wisely." Now Fran beamed proudly. Raoul said, "You know Nikos, of course." She kissed his cheek, saying, "Thank you for everything." He shrugged and blushed. "And Alma, this is Larry." Larry's eyes gushed tears as she pulled himself up to greet her. "No, stay resting, please," she insisted. "I'll get a chair." May rose, saying, "I've warmed a spot for you." Larry patted where May had been sitting, welcoming Alma to it. She snugged in close. While she and Larry talked, Raoul kept May, Fran, the Anne, and Nikos entertained with backstage stories. Larry said quietly, "I met your mother the day before she went to Jeddah. We only had 10 minutes together, but she had an amazing impact on me while I did nothing for her. I'm so sorry. I could have helped. I could have investigated after," and he broke down. "Shh," Alma said softly. "You inspired her, more than you know, more than I can tell you at this juncture. As for her protest, there was nothing you could have done before or after. Any interference would have made things worse, believe me. There are ways you can help now, however. Anything, whatever you say." Alma shook her head. "No, whatever you say, from your heart. What would you like to do for her now, or make of the advice she gave you?" Larry took shallow breaths, struggling to match words with feelings. Alma took his hand and waited. At last he said, "Raoul said you videotaped your performance tonight. I'd like to run it, play it up, give the world half the jolt I got seeing you on stage tonight." Alma smiled. "I'm sure that some in the audience videoed it. I'm sure that it's going viral as we speak. I'm sure that big media, even Media 8, will give it some coverage, then move on. It'll soon be old news. There's a deeper story to tell, well beyond Maya's demise." "Then what can I..." Larry's voice trailed off in confusion. Alma continued quietly. "There's so much that the world doesn't know and won't be ready to accept, not until the groundwork is laid. Improving the rights of women worldwide is one requisite, and this present effort is one small tool. Maya isn't the point of tonight's exercise. Effecting change is through the concerted engagement of all who know better. That's what she died for." Larry closed his eyes, confused at his lack of understanding and pained at his continuing powerlessness to help Maya. "So what's the deeper point of your staging tonight?" "We needed the performance in front of a live audience, precisely to capture the response it got on video. It was perfect. Raoul and I also arranged for professional footage to be shot. It's, for the record, part of a much, much bigger story, and it's to add to May's prodigious files." Alma slowed her words to see if Larry was curious about exploring that broad avenue, but the news hound kept to the obvious. So it kicks off a petition and some fundraising, which I gather you want publicized? Yes. Can I direct all of Media 8's reporting on it? Oh, yes, any and all of your media. In whatever manner you choose to use the viral videos, the audience response, the follow-up, etc. Great. That said, Larry, what's missing, overlooked, or forgotten is the point, and most pointedly with regard to women's rights in so many parts of the world, there's a hole at the core of every powerful story, which is completed by dropping in the missing piece. Rosebud, Larry whispered, goosebumps rising. Alma smiled. Yes. I'll get my team right on it, picking up from the first postings and running with it, as far as we can, every angle possible. Thank you. Alma grinned happily. Now, Mother told me she gave you a piece of paper containing essentially a recipe. The idea for it is actually mine. She was my messenger. Although I didn't know who she'd share it with, I just knew she'd choose well. Larry winced. I haven't done anything with it. I mean, beyond the first point, news and systemic context, the wider view. That's what I put Fran up to when she found Angela. Talk about payoff. Did your mother really work with Orson, the attentive Mr. Wells, as she called him? He listened to her, yes, and look at what he achieved. So the first half of point one of my suggestions, as you understood it, served you well. It's more than that, plus there's a second part, Gaia Incorporated. Yeah, that's the big earth corporate thing, right? That one escapes me in terms of everyday news telling. You're not alone in that. If you get the hang of it, you'll be on your own, definitely not mainstream, something much bigger and more cumulatively important and sustaining. Then there are the two other points on my list, each integral to the other. Are you interested in how they fit together? A puzzle, for sure. As something practical, doable? I wouldn't know. Can you tell me? Or is it all riddles for me to figure out, or someone a lot smarter? Alma laughed. If not you, then no one. Point two is simple. Audiences must have a vested interest in news and its telling, the same as live performances need their audiences for feedback and feed-forward, and not just in notes to the editor and comments on posts, but as stakeholders in the production. The news business now is run like banks, with account holders or subscribers on one hand and shareholders on the other. The credit union model is needed, where account holders are shareholders with voting shares. They select the directors, the investments, the community supports, and so on, and thus attract more like-minded people to become subscriber shareholders. These joint owner-operators sign on to the philosophy and direction of the publication and then have a say over how it's implemented. Judiciously, of course, hiring and keeping on management personnel to a feedback mechanism that serves continuity and orderly change, staying the course and moving with the times. Point three, closed-loop production and delivery, is the Gaia part in practical everyday terms, taking no more from Earth and its gifts than is returned in functional state, the circular economy and all that. Without this, the rest is moot and pointless, just more of the same, which is killing us, killing you. My God, Larry said in awe. I think I'm getting it, Alma smiled. Then perhaps Mother was right. She was hopeful about you. With rising enthusiasm, Larry said, it's brilliant. It makes total sense. It's a massive idea, though. She laughed. Could you do it? Someone has to. It's too good not to get done. I'm asking you. Larry took a deep breath. I suppose. Yeah, you know, I could. It'd take $1 million to get started, a handful of good people, and a world network of experts. It would be fabulously exciting. If you're interested, and you're the only one who's seen or heard the plan, it's yours, unless you don't act on it in, say, the next 6 months. As for financial backing, I can work that out, as much money as you want. Are you serious? Larry asked, disbelievingly. Alma looked him hard in the eye. Completely. Are you? Larry nodded slowly, solemnly. Alma said, it's got to be drawn up first, the whole organization, a business plan, marketing strategies, timelines, etc. Perhaps a good activity while you're recuperating, and you could work from here, from home. Larry's pulse raced, his cheeks pinker than they'd been in months. Yes, yes, it's so perfect. It's telling news exactly the way I'd like to see it told in delivery. Well, it's bound to fly. I'm in a morass at work, desperate to do something that makes a difference. His eyes brimmed with joyous tears as he said with conviction, Alma, I can do it. I will do it. Alma beamed. So get to it, minding your health, of course. When it's all outlined and ready, you'll be surprised at how quickly it comes together and takes off. Larry blinked in disbelief. Was he dreaming that he could kick off something, a real-world something, with as much lasting impact as his movie hero had done? He reached for Alma's hand, holding it for long, sweet seconds before she said, "I'm sorry, but I must go." She kissed his forehead. Larry kissed her hand before letting it go, smiling and flushed with her blessing. Alma stood up and said warmly, extending her arms to Raoul, "Thank you, Raoul. You are splendid. Your show is most compelling and worthwhile, sure to make a difference. Now I must vanish." As they hugged, the aunt said, "Wait, I want to get a picture of everyone." The party quickly gathered around Larry. Others took shots amidst quick shuffling and small talk to arrange and rearrange the party. Alma stood behind the high end of the divan. Flashes and smiles done, Alma said, "I really must go. Delightful, truly, to have met you, Larry, Fran, the aunt." She beamed at each person in turn. "And Nikos, again, I owe you for your brilliant driving and care." Shyly, he dropped his head and quickly said, "I could drive you now." "Thank you, but I'm safe for tonight, as safe as can be." To May, she said, "I'll see you soon," and blew her a kiss. Fran followed Alma and Raoul to the door, then said quietly, urgently, to Alma, "I have to talk with you." She showed her Pavla Blanca's card. "I got this from Athens, just as you planned, yes? Is she your daughter, playing Gaia tonight?" "Oh, dear, I'm late as it is." "Keep on the file, Fran. The answers are in there. Our reenactment tonight is important, but in other ways, not this. Try parthenogenesis." Fran looked at her quizzically. Alma smiled for all and waved goodbye. Poof, she was gone.